everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pulse.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Inkblack Heart, this time covering chapters 88 through 92 of Part 5 with a guest we've never had on the show before. Kurt Schreier is an associate professor of English at the University of Missouri-St. Louis, where he teaches courses on Shakespeare and early English drama. He also wrote a fabulous post on our website challenging the associations we make with gravesites and death, which I'll link in the show notes. And he can be found on Twitter at his handle KASSTL1. Thank you for coming on, Kurt.
Thank you. It's an honor. I love the podcast.
Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Inkblack Heart will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series. Now, obviously, before we get started on anything, listeners have been looking forward to us reacting to a certain thing that happened over the past couple of episodes, and that is that we got the cover and synopsis for The Running Grave.
Oh my God.
I haven't stopped freaking out. I don't know about you guys.
I've been the same way. I'm thinking I'm done freaking out, and then I think about the stuff that we knew before the cover and synopsis came out, and then it's just the cycle just starts all over again.
Yeah, I keep having new thoughts about it, and then just getting excited again, and then I'll forget about it. And I'm like, oh my God, we're getting the book soon. It's like 2 months away. It's so close.
I was surprised it wasn't the so-called lion's mouth.
Oh, the church?
The road. The spooky road, yes. Right?
I felt like there was the choice of the pier, the church, or that road. And we're like, which one is it going to be?
Well, I'm glad it's the pier because I want the ocean.
Oh, I'm just so excited to see how all these locations show up in the books.
I have some thoughts.
Okay.
Let's dissect the cover first. Let's go over the cover first. There's less with this one than the Inkblack Heart, right?
It was a bit more crowded.
Yeah.
This one is much simpler.
It is. Mm-hmm. But I think out of all the covers, this one is the one that would draw me in the most. I really like it. I like the beachy vibes. Mm-hmm. You know, it manages to be beachy, but also sinister at the same time. I think it's gorgeous. I really like it. I like the yellow font.
I'm intrigued by the yellow font.
I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about your being intrigued. I read what she wrote. I don't want to talk about it.
We're gonna, because it's in the notes, Lindsay.
I'm a big fan of the cover too. Initially, I wasn't a huge fan of the yellow text, but it's growing on me now.
Well, now I've changed my mind.
Yeah, I'm a fan of it too.
But yeah, this cover is gorgeous.
So talking about the yellow, because some people have been like, it looks so weird with the gold, it doesn't fit. And I'm like, well, I think that it's there for a specific reason.
Talk about your reason.
I have a prediction. Follow me on my reasoning here. What color do you paint things that you want to be able to find at sea, right? Stuff like lifeboats, buoys, submersibles, that shade of yellow, that's the shade you use. That's a high vis. We want to be able to find it in the dark gray ocean kind of color. So what if someone is lost adrift at sea at some point and needs to be found? What if this cult has been taking people into the ocean and dumping them there? It's a pretty hard to track murder method. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah, and I hate it. I hate it.
What if at the climax of the novel, Robin is adrift at sea alone and someone has to try to find her?
I hate this because I thought the same thing and I didn't want anyone to say it out loud. And now you have.
I've put that into the universe.
You've spoken it into existence.
It's literally one of my greatest fears. I don't want it to happen to Robin.
I wish that my words had the power to speak things in these books into existence. They don't appear to.
That's comforting.
You don't want this to happen to Robin?
No cannibals are being buried alive.
Still room for that. But no, I'm lost at sea. Maybe Polworth can come in from the other side of the country and help him look.
I was thinking about Polworth too coming into this and somebody having to be rescued. I'll just say someone to be rescued at sea. Well, Polworth has to be there. I think it's a very intriguing theory. And I like it, even though, like Lindsay, I'm the idea of drowning. I've had recurring dreams about drowning and losing loved ones at sea and that sort of thing too. So,
I mean, I guess I'll get over it if they kiss. If he rescues her and they kiss, I'll be fine then.
What if the reason he's able to find her is the sunlight glinting off of her hair? I'm not saying it's likely, but possible.
I'm trying to comfort myself with all of the crazy, scary things that we came up with for Inkblack Heart and that didn't happen.
What did we come up with for Inkblack Heart?
I don't know, stuff, Pools. Just stuff that didn't happen. Just trying to comfort myself.
All right. I have other...
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let's go on.
I have other thoughts on the cover. First of all, the clouds, they look really spooky and ominous, like a storm coming in.
And there was that audio on the Instagram post, the teaser mm-hmm. thing.
That was like a storm.
It was like a stormy. And you can hear the waves coming up.
Yeah, like a storm at sea.
Mm-hmm. It does make me think of Troubled Blood because they had rain on that announcement video too. Mm-hmm. You remember? And we did get that storm when they're trying to get to Joan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are we going to have another storm in this book while Robin is adrift at sea?
You know what? Okay. Sorry. Were there any storms around Norfolk at this time of the book?
I actually found one. Storm Katie was in March of 2016. I think it hit Norfolk on Easter Monday with really high winds and rain and branches coming down and all that stuff. So mm-hmm. to me, that seems like it could be something. Like it would be great weather for like a frightening climactic showdown with the cult leader on the ocean. I don't know.
It would be a lost opportunity to not have Strike save Robin's life during something like this. Just putting that out there.
Or a lost opportunity not to make out in the rain.
My next thought, because we've been talking so much about bird symbolism, that seagull that's perched above them, right above mm-hmm. them, front and center, solitary bird looming over them. I think it could have some symbolism.
Okay, let's hear it.
One, I found that dreaming of a seagull before facing a big decision indicates a dangerous mm-hmm. outcome. Since a seagull can weather any storm, the gull is a sign to trust your instincts, prepare for the worst, and know that you'll be okay. What big decision with a possible scary outcome could Strike have to face where he needs to just trust his instincts and go with his heart?
Okay, I don't hate it.
Thank you. Point two, seagulls mate for life, according to the internet. Also something that we love.
Yeah.
And I was also remembering that seagull that was in Troubled Blood, where after Joan's funeral, Strike was watching this seagull and his eyes were focused on something he couldn't see. And he watched it fly away from the shelter of the harbor, focused on the hard business of survival. I don't know what it means, but it was mentioned like four times he was watching this seagull, and it could be some mm-hmm. seagull foreshadowing. My favorite point, Strike and Robin. Okay, let me paint this picture. Strike and Robin at the pier. Having a beautiful day together. Strike's in such a good mood. He buys himself a treat, some chips, to celebrate being with Robin because he's been so good on his diet. He gets to sit down with his little chips and a seagull steals them.
Jail.
I just think that seagull could be Strike's new Moriarty, that's all.
It's a very specific situation.
Perfect karma for the guy who's always stealing food off of other people. I know.
The kleptomaniac gets his comeuppance. His food is stolen. Circle of life. Anyway, I'm sensing that you're not taking my theorizing seriously.
Look, as much as I like the mating for life thing or the dream thing, I really think it's just about making it more recognizable as being by the ocean.
Okay, mm-hmm. That is good visual language, yeah.
I don't think that the waves are really that recognizable for normal readers, people not like us who don't, you know, already know.
Yeah.
Because to me, I think the waves can kind of blend in with the darkened sky. Mm. I don't know. We all got caught up on the magpie on the cover of Ink Black Heart. People were really worried about that magpie. And I guess there mm-hmm. is one in the book, but it's not the way people were thinking.
I get you. It's visual language for readers who aren't insane.
It's also in the stock photo, too.
That's from a stock photo?
Yes.
Oh, and finally, my final thought here is that on the cover, Robin is walking towards Strike, which mm-hmm. I feel like that's significant. Also, she's wearing earmuffs. So winter?
It's probably safe to guess it's cold because of the earmuffs. Yep. I don't know if I put too much thought into their body language or how they're standing because I don't really think it's ever given us anything before.
No.
I mean, they're both running on the cover of Troubled Blood, and I can't think of what that would be. Unless they're running away from Irene. But I don't know. There wasn't a scene where they're both running.
True. They didn't both run at any point in Troubled Blood, did they? Mm-hmm.
I know people want to analyze how close they're standing together, but I just don't think it means anything.
Well, I mean, they're really close in like all the covers. I'm not sure that Joe's going full like Taylor Swift, you know, with the Easter eggs and stuff.
Yeah.
If she had a better promotional team, maybe she would be going full Easter egg.
I think she likes to do that stuff secretly. Do you remember the wombat test before Deathly Hallows came out? She put them on her website and it was mm-hmm. like a test that you had to take as if you're in the wizarding world.
I remember trying to take them once and it frustrated the hell out of me. Yeah.
They were hard. She explained that the reason why she did the wombat test is because her lawyers told her not to put any clues on her website because it would lessen her copyright. So what she did was she put all of these clues inside this test and she goes, and no one ever noticed. And I gave a bunch of clues away and ha 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 ha. And it was like,
aw,
so great. So yeah, I feel like she would do that secretly.
Interesting. Anyway. Okay. So should I be paying more attention to the Robert Galbraith crossword puzzles?
No, I think you should be paying more attention to her stuff. Should we go to the synopsis? Who wants to read it?
I feel like Kurt's our guest.
All right, I'll give it a go. In the seventh installment in Strike series, Cormoran and Robin must rescue a man ensnared in the trap of a dangerous cult. Private detective Cormoran Strike is contacted by a worried father whose son, Will, has gone to join a religious cult in the depths of the Norfolk countryside. The Universal Humanitarian Church is, on the surface, a peaceable organization that campaigns for a better world. Yet Strike discovers that beneath the surface, there are deeply sinister undertones and unexplained deaths. In order to try to rescue Will, Strike's business partner, Robin Ellicott, decides to infiltrate the cult, and she travels to Norfolk to live incognito among its members. But in doing so, she is unprepared for the dangers that await her there, or for the toll it will take on her. Utterly page-turning, The Running Grave moves Strike and Robin's story forward in this epic, unforgettable seventh installment of the series.
That was so good. I'm so excited. My level of excitement can't get much higher.
Hear, hear. Same.
I am so excited, but also I'm terrified.
Yes.
This terrifies me.
You're such a baby. They'll both be fine.
We are right to dread it.
Oh, that's true, Kurt. We are right to dread that commune.
But Pools, I'm going to need you to just be just there in the corner for the next couple months, just saying that on repeat to me.
They're going to be fine.
They're going to be fine.
They're the protagonists. Mm-hmm.
I know. And I know you're going to finish it before me. So while I'm reading, just a couple, they're going to be fine.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
Just throw it out.
Yeah.
I'm going to need you to be like my cheerleader.
I'll do some emoji clues as to what kind of thing need to brace yourself for.
No, don't right? do that.
No, don't do that. Okay.
No. You're right. Terrified.
I think I'm going to try and avoid actually reading the sample because I feel like it's gonna make me so anxious.
Got more willpower than I do.
Yeah, there's no way I could do that.
Not read that sample.
No. After you read it, I'm gonna ask one of you how you feel about it and if it makes
there's
you
no way I'm
how we feel about it. There's gonna be one feeling and that's gonna be our just brains are on
screaming.
Fire.
Yeah.
You know, like
oh my other God.
Feelings. I'm like, oh no, it was a bit shit. Don't bother with it. Come on, Ted.
No. I wasn't expecting that. Just oh man.
But if they say Nick and Ilsa or christening or something like that, Ken. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? You need to think about now what you're going to do if you learn that sample is shippy.
Yeah, I don't know.
If this book opened up on the christening, oh my God.
The last opening was pretty shippy, so.
So maybe it won't be.
Oh my goodness.
No, I mean, maybe it will be.
There'll be some angsty internal monologues.
It opens up on the christening and Robin's brought Murphy as her date.
Oh God. The funny thing is, this sounds so much like what we and others have been predicting that I wasn't sure if this was real at first because the one bookstore posted it early. It wasn't until Mulholland Books liked Bill's post that we knew it was real.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it makes sense because the clues have been there with this one. We've gone into this knowing more than I think we ever have before. So it makes sense that a lot of people were guessing correctly. I definitely remember Sue saying something about a religious cult on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we've thrown the idea out there before Robin going undercover in this kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were talking about it in regards to the commune that Strike was in as a child, but it's still pretty close. Kenz, I think you were the one to suggest Robin going undercover and living there. And I think I said that I wasn't sure about that because we know that she always needs to feel safe where she's sleeping. That sounds familiar to me, although I don't remember when that happened. But maybe that's where the unprepared for the toll it will take on her line comes from.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was me, if I'm remembering correctly. So I'll take it as a win. But yeah, the whole control over where she sleeps thing is definitely going to take its toll on her, I think. And something interesting that one of our listeners brought up after episode 22 came out was the line in Ink Black Heart where Robin says that she couldn't imagine living in a commune and that she doesn't get it. And knowing what we know now, it kind of reads like a neat bit of foreshadowing looking back at it. Another thing I was thinking about was what the toll would be having to be undercover all the time, obviously, aside from any time she might be alone with Strike, and the toll that's going to take on her with all of her other prior bits of undercover work. She's been able to take off her disguise at the end of the day and become herself again. But this would be like a 24/7 kind of situation. So I can't imagine that that would be easy for her.
No, it wouldn't. That's a really good point, Kenz. Of course, we still don't know exactly what the living situation is going to be. I think your take is probably right because the Live Incognito among its members does suggest that, but maybe she'll have some sort of space to herself. I guess the reason I'm thinking that is because I'm sure she's going to have a way to remain in contact with Strike for at least most of it.
Or she's out of contact and Strike is frantic with worry 100% of the time, which I think is also a possibility.
I just don't know how that moves other things forward.
Yeah.
You know, like if there's zero contact between them, how does any of the personal move forward?
Well, it moves forward for them internally where they have time to stew in their feeling.
But there's other things as well, like Murphy and Charlotte. How does all of that go forward if Robin's just gone the whole time? Like that part just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, we'll see. I was wondering, since this is sort of a missing person case, and this speaks to what we were just talking about, Robin will probably go to the cult pretty early in the book to find the kid, right? Because you want to get it done quickly. Time is of the essence. She might leave to go undercover before they've had a chance to uncover any of the really disturbing stuff. Imagine how Strike will feel at home researching this history and getting more and more scared for her safety while she's there.
See, I actually thought the opposite.
Yeah.
I wasn't considering Will a missing person because they know exactly where he is. They just want him to come home and leave the cult. So I could see them trying other ways to reach out to him and then ultimately deciding that they need to go in.
Okay.
I guess I'm also thinking this because I'm imagining some sort of dramatic rescue at the end. And like I just said, I don't see her being gone for the entire book and missing out on all of those personal moments. So I don't know.
Maybe you split the difference. She goes to Norfolk early on, but she has to wait for the cult to like approach her to infiltrate gradually, so it's normal, right?
Right.
So she doesn't actually lose contact with Strike until much later when they take away her cell phone when she's fully inducted. And then they're out of contact for a little while. And then, you know, you get the dramatic rescue. Yeah. It all works out.
That makes a lot of sense. Maybe they'll rent a place up there so that she can stay and looks like she's living nearby. And then she goes in, Strike can stay there because I have some thoughts, but I think that he might stay nearby. On the other hand, it could happen fairly quickly because we know that it didn't take Flick long at all to offer Robin a place to stay.
And cults are usually pretty eager to get people into them, right?
I don't know. I've never been in one.
Neither have I.
Do you guys think that Robin is going to end up cutting or dyeing her hair since she's going to be undercover for a while?
Oh,
I hadn't thought of that. And I hate it, just like what Poole said earlier.
Yeah, I don't like it.
It might sound silly, but I really hope not. I feel attached to her hair.
Me too.
Which it sounds like a ridiculous thing to say.
I know, because on the one hand, it's just hair.
It's grows hair.
Back, I know. You know, it's not her worth.
It was an important symbol in Ink Black Heart.
With Madeline?
Yeah, exactly. The connection with Madeline. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
And the sort of false gold, true gold.
Yeah. You can't cover up the gold.
She could use a semi-permanent dye because that will fade after so many washes. And then that would be fine.
Will it?
Yeah. I guess it depends on how long she's there. If she's just there a few weeks, that would work.
Maybe she could bring extra dye with her.
But also with dye, even any kind of dye, it's going to grow out after a few weeks anyway.
Mm.
I don't know. It could be that this cult is so far away from London that they might be removed from media, you know, that she doesn't need to do that, but that could be risky. I think it is something they'll have to think about, but
yeah.
I hope not.
Aww.
If she does dye it, and then at the end of the novel, if we see her with her normal gold, right, it might be a kind of Solvay Coagula kind of gesture, moment, or movement, you know, and then we find the true gold and it's right at that important, you know, romantic moment, maybe. But I get why you don't like the idea of dyeing it.
I guess I have to remind myself that it's fictional.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure she could do that. In real life, from my experience, when you do dye your hair with an actual permanent dye, it is very hard to get your natural color back. And so that's what scares me.
She'd have to wait for it to grow out the whole.
Yeah, but a semi-permanent would fade. So I'll allow it if it's that.
Well, it's just because Strike loves her hair so much.
I know. It's been a thing since the beginning. I'm thinking of Silkworm when he doesn't want to tell her how memorable her hair is. And
it's making me go crazy. But I know he'll still love her just as much, even if she dyes her hair. Get that.
It's ridiculous.
But how will he be able to find her at sea with dark dyed hair is my question.
Oh,
she needs that high visibility hair.
You guys. Oh my God. Joe's current header
is someone floating is a
woman
sea?
At sea.
Mm-hmm. With dark hair. Oh no.
Okay.
No. Oh no. God. Why would you say that? I did have one other thought. As far as alter egos that she could take on, I've seen it suggested that she might try and make a new alter ego, and that just to choose a new surname, that she might choose something with Murphy's last name, and Spike would just like lose his mind and read way too much into it.
That would be so funny.
I thought that would have some excellent comedic potential.
Yeah.
He's over here just losing his mind.
But you know who is not going to be happy about this?
The undercover thing?
Mm-hmm.
Who?
Linda.
Oh, definitely right? Not.
Do you think that Robin will even tell her she's going undercover?
I don't know.
If she thinks she's only going to be gone a couple weeks, she might sort of fudge the reason why she's not calling and just right. say, oh, I'm really busy, I'll call you, you know. What if there's a family emergency while Robin's gone and Linda can't get in touch with Robin, so she calls Strike to find out what's happening?
Oh no.
Oh
dear.
That
would be fun.
Bye-bye, Michael.
I can see her telling Linda with the sort of defiance that she kind of had in that one phone call.
Oh yeah.
Oh, that was so good.
You know, kind of like, I'm doing this whether you like it or not kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or Strike can, you know, win her over by saving Robin, and then Linda loves him.
I hope Strike can win her over.
He will eventually.
There does seem to be kind of an element of, and maybe I don't know how much I'm reading into this, but it says that Robin decides to go and live incognito amongst its members. How is Strike going to feel about that? Is she doing that against Strike's judgment?
I don't think Strike will be thrilled, but I think they'll agree that she goes. I think he's just going to be
not happy about it,
worried and unhappy about it, but they'll probably agree.
This must be the occasion then when his history at the commune comes out, or it's a very likely candidate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's going to say, okay, do you know what you're getting yourself into? Because I do. And here's what happened to me.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be so good.
Because, you know, he doesn't like to tell anything about himself, his history, his dad, his trousers. But if it means Robin's safety, then he would. He absolutely would share it. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that could be a fun argument.
I love that.
That would be so good. Oh my gosh.
I just don't see her doing anything without him knowing after the Ricci fight in Trouble Blood, where they've agreed how they're going to move forward. And I feel like they've kind of even gotten there a little bit more so in Ink Black Heart. I don't see that happening again.
And logistically, she can't just disappear to go undercover for weeks without Strike being on board.
Pat would have a fit.
Yeah. Pat.
Definitely.
Or their accountant.
Yep. He would actually shit some staples.
Yeah.
But you know, the dark side of Strike revealing his history at the commune in terms of Robin is then when she goes undercover, if he has told her his experience, right, that's going to haunt her. That's going to make it could make it worse in some way, if that makes sense.
Knowing what happened to him, well, it would certainly raise her anxiety levels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If she has an idea of what might happen, right?
So maybe he wouldn't tell her.
Well, I think he would want to.
He would want her to be very nervous.
And be extra careful.
I think it would work.
I've also had about 1,000 different Strike rescuing Robin scenarios going on in my head.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Like a ramped up version of Lethal White.
Oh, yeah. That was so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wonder what Murphy is going to think about all this.
You know, I haven't really thought of him that much. Weird.
Honestly, I'm so surprised.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wonder what he's going to think about all this, and if what happens in this book with regard to the whole commune thing, if that's going to end up breaking up their relationship at the end or introduce some major fractures that will break them up later. Just doesn't sound like she's going to have a whole lot of time to like cuddle up with him and get cozy. So.
Oh, how sad.
I know. Tell me how you really feel, Lindsay.
Okay, well, here's a thought. We know some other locations because of Joe's headers. And the ones that I'm specifically thinking about are the church and Lion's Mouth, which is that somewhat secluded looking road. I'm just going to throw out this scenario that Strike will stay nearby or at least go up to check on her. And they might use Lion's Mouth to meet up because it's pretty secluded. Mm-hmm. And they could talk without anybody seeing them.
Mm-hmm.
But the church, we know that Strike sits in the pew in the back because Joe told Bill that he does. So what if he goes to this church because he knows she'll be there with the other members? They'll have to pretend like they don't know each other. And in my experience, there's that moment in a church service where they tell you to greet each other.
There is.
I'm imagining this whole thing where they shake hands and say hello, but he kind of gives her hand a squeeze and doesn't let go right away.
Oh, okay.
And they do that thing where they like slowly break apart, hands touching for as long as possible.
You know what that moment is called?
No, what?
Or traditionally in the ancient church, it was called the kiss of peace.
Really?
Oh, okay.
So wow. I'm just throwing that out there. Do you do with that or not?
What I like that. Can you imagine the angst and the pining and the yearning.
Yeah.
This might put me in my grave.
I don't know. This plot just makes me think it might be even more likely that he tells her he loves her, but maybe that's just wishful thinking.
No. Everything about this says to me that it's very likely Strick will tell her he loves her because there's danger. Danger leads to love confessions. That's a fact.
I throw this out there. Just the fact that a specific pew or seat is mentioned made me think, is the church a location for a drop? That is, yeah. You know, messages exchanged. Maybe it's stuck under the pew at that seat.
Oh my God.
I love that. Some spy shit.
Or in the book. So Robin and Stryker using it as a drop location or something like that.
That's a great idea.
That would be
idea.
So good.
I love
in the
that
books
idea.
Makes so much sense.
A little more spy came in from the cold.
Okay, I'm convinced that's happening.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that the spy stuff was foreshadowing.
Yeah, even though I want the hand touching, I like that better than mine. That's good.
I think I just made a prediction and yeah, I guess I'm on the record for that.
It's a good prediction. I like
we'll
it.
We'll see.
It's slightly less angsty, but I do wonder if Strike's going to go into the church by himself, either in between or after services, just because it seems like it's a good place for introspection and nice, long internal monologues about how concerned he is for Robin and her safety and, mm-hmm. you know, memories of what he and Lucy went through.
It could be. I do love a Strike internal monologue. So
yeah, you know. I'm certain we're going to get so many of those mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. church, out of church, anywhere.
In a pub. I don't care.
You don't have to twist the arm of a Shakespearean to like internal monologue. So I'm all for that, Kenz.
I am all for it as well.
On another note, I also hope that they save Will. You know, yeah. I think that other people are going to die, but it would be nice if they could save him.
That would be such a nice ending. I really hope we get that.
Unless, and now here is another thing I thought, what if Will is brainwashed by this cult to become a murderer?
Ooh.
What if this is like a Charles Manson type of situation where she draws on the family as influence mm-hmm. for building this cult and Will is saved, but he's murdered people and he's going to jail?
That could also bring Whitaker back up in some sort of way since he was such
the Manson thing.
Fan of Charles Manson. Yeah. I was thinking that the danger would be towards the members themselves, you know, if they questioned authority or something like that, but there's no reason that it can't be both, I guess.
Yeah, no reason.
That would be quite sad, actually.
Yeah, it would be.
And I think as much as we'd like to think it can't happen to us or someone we know, it could. So I feel like I'm rooting for Will.
Well, fingers crossed. I don't know if it sounds good for Will, but I hope I'm wrong.
I saw someone say on Twitter where there's a will, there's a way. And I liked that.
Aw, that's cute. Maybe Will helps Strike save Robin.
Speaking of Will, I mean, we have another character with a Bill or William, you know, derivative name. We had Billy and Willem. There's also a variation on William.
Is it Matthew's son, William, too?
I feel like I've seen that, but that might just be fan.
I feel like there's another one, too.
It's not fanfic because I wouldn't have read it.
No, you wouldn't have. I'm in the Strike Finder now. I'm going to William. Oh, wow. There's a William in all of the books. Interesting. Yes, Matthew's kid is named William. Well, so Billy and Gullerm are both very vulnerable. And both have mental health / mental development issues. That could be an interesting pattern if we've got Will in that sort of grouping as well. I'm intrigued by that.
I guess overall, as nervous as I am for Robin, and I'm very nervous, I am really here for this plot. There's so much potential. I think it's going to be so good.
Mm-hmm. Same.
No real mention of anything personal in this synopsis. You know, the most we get is that the running grave moves Strike and Robin's story forward. Don't know how we're interpreting that.
I mean, take a guess about how I'm interpreting that. I'm interpreting that as a huge positive sign that they are moving forward. I think they're just being cagey in the blurb to avoid spoilers.
Yeah. You said that with Ink Black Heart, and I think that you were right because both of them admitting that it's love was a huge step forward.
They almost kissed. That's a thing.
Sure. It was a thing. I remember I was there.
Yeah. I think more stuff is going to happen in this book.
Yeah. But it's not just their relationship. You know, there's no mention of Murphy. There's no mention of Strike getting healthy or Prudence. And I'm very curious about all of that. But this was very focused on the case. So it just makes me more curious and more excited for those things.
When you compare it to the synopsis of Ink Black Heart, which goes out of its way to mention business interests, family conflicts to navigate, and that sort of thing. It is conspicuously about the case, isn't it?
I'm going to take the same position that I took for Ink Black Heart, in that the more coy they are about the personal stuff, the more interesting bits of that we tend to get in the book. Because whatever happens on the personal / relationship leadership front, it's going to be super interesting.
Yeah. I've kind of been laughing a bit at just thinking of how wrong we must have been when we did our Ink Black Heart post cover and synopsis episode. So I wonder how we're going to do this time. I feel like we should all make a pact to just not go back and listen to this after the book comes out.
Absolutely.
Unless we're right.
I never look back.
I'm way too afraid to go back and listen to older episodes. I feel like I would die inside a little bit. Yeah. I remember some of the things we got wrong were obviously that Shrike and Robin were going to be in Highgate together. To be fair, it's on the cover, which is why I don't put so much into that.
Yeah.
I do remember us being worried that Anime was going to blackmail or hijack their business, their phones or their computers or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I was a little worried about that.
Yeah, we thought that was going to happen. But now that we have the cover and synopsis, please start sending us your predictions for the Running Graves so we can try and include them in a predictions episode. And I think we decided that we're going to be recording that on August 12th. So try and get those in before then if you can.
Yep.
All right. Should we go into chapter 88?
Chapter 88.
Yes.
Kurt, when I asked you if you wanted to be on with us, I remember that this was the chapter that you were like, I want this one.
Absolutely. I wanted a front yeah. row seat to the Strike and Ellicott Files podcasters talking about this slightly shippy, maybe sort
slightly
of.
Shippy.
Slightly. Understatement of the year.
I love it.
I have some thoughts too, but I'm really eager to hear what you guys have to say about this moment.
We did promise like 5 minutes of boob talk, so I guess we got to get into it.
All right, so in chapter 88, Robin tells Strike about being banned from Drek's game. The epigraph for this chapter: behold how quickly melted from your sight the promised objects you esteemed so bright. And that is from Sonnet by Mary Teague. And I think this is speaking to Robin being banned from the game and then the hope of experiencing a breakthrough in the case because of the mod chat just sort of slipping away.
I think you're exactly right. Getting in with the mods has been something that they've been putting a lot of hope into. And we know that from one of the last chapters that Strike tells the whole team that he thinks that this is the key to breaking the case. But I also want to be shippy for a second because this epigraph is how I feel at the end of this chapter, where I was on the edge of my seat with the two of them sitting on a bed in a hotel, drinking whiskey and Robin wearing not that much. And Strike is all heart eyes for her. And then he just gets up and leaves. I was like, yes, behold how quickly it melted from my sight, the promised shippiness I esteemed so bright.
If I could have, I would have nailed his foot to the floor so that he couldn't leave. I love both of those interpretations. Obviously, yes, big mood on that last bit, Lindsay.
Yeah.
I also kind of think that this might be reiterating Strike's disillusionment with Charlotte. He once has seen her. He saw a future with her, but now, and I'm going to quote some other lines from this poem that I think really fit this. She seeks repose and owns at last how sighs and tears and youth were spent in vain. While languishing, she mourned in folly's sad control. Obviously switch the sex of the speaker there, but Carmen is seeking rest and comfort with Robin, and he's realized just how much he's wasted on Charlotte and probably feeling like a bit of a fool for it. You know,
it's really my favorite thing when the epigraph works for both the case and the personal. I'm just always impressed at her ability to choose such perfectly fitting epigraphs.
Those are the best ones.
This chapter starts up where the last chapter left off, with Strike having finally cast the Charlotte albatross from off of his neck. Hallelujah.
Ken's, that's a great 19th century poetry reference.
Thank you.
If it was a female poet, it could have been perfect. But hey, it's a Coleridge.
I can't say I blame him for wanting a drink after that whole scene at the Rosses, to be honest.
I want a drink, but in a celebratory kind of way. You know, I feel we should all do a virtual cheers.
Yes.
Cheers to the demise of Charlotte, figuratively.
Yes, all the listeners can join in too.
Yes, cheers.
Strike arrives at the Zed Hotel and can immediately tell something is wrong as soon as he sees Robin.
We know that Robin was trying to text him and he wasn't answering, but it seemed lucky that she heard him go by. I'm assuming that's why it says that his bottles were clanking so that she could hear him. I'm just imagining her jumping up as soon as she hears those bottles so quickly that, you know, forgets to put a bra on.
Between the loud clanking bottles and the fact that she's been working with him for like 5 years, I'm pretty sure that she would hear his walk like a mile off. She can read immediately.
Okay, that's sweet.
That is really sweet.
But anyway, okay, so we're getting to an important moment here. I don't think that we would be us if we didn't point out where both Strike and Robin notice that Robin isn't wearing a bra while she's on the game in her PJs.
Yeah.
Ellicott 4, Corson Miles, nil.
So I think J.K. Rowling is using Robin's breasts meaningfully as a kind of touchstone. That's sort of a weird word to use in literary context. But what I mean is, like, a touchstone was originally a stone with the power to test for the purity of precious metals like gold. But over time, as people moved away from alchemy and not everybody's doing chemistry, this kind of definition evolved to mean anything. A touchstone is anything that serves to test the genuineness or the value of something. So a touchstone is a test, a trial, a criterion by which something, or in my case here, someone can be judged. And I've tweeted a little bit about this. You know, the references to Robin's breasts in the early chapters of The Cuckoo's Calling, right? If you can think back to that very memorable first meeting, right?
Oh, yeah. we definitely can. Yeah. Yeah.
So here it is. I think it's being used as a kind of touchstone of male behavior, specifically Strike's behavior versus Matthew's behavior. You know, references to her breasts help to establish that Strike's a decent guy. Right. It's this indirect way of telling us, you know, he's okay. He's not a creep. He's not taking advantage of the situation. He's not doing all the things that Matthew imagines that he is. Right.
Right.
In the way that he looks at Robin. We remember that moment after their collision where he pretends not to notice that she's rubbing her bruises. Then there's that moment when he wants to make a joke about Batman and Robin, but he thinks, oh, this could be misinterpreted to mean Robin Redbreast.
Actually, Kurt, yeah, he makes the joke but doesn't realize that it could be a reference.
That's right.
Because he just wants to be Batman.
Yes,
Robin thinks, oh my god, he's joking about my boob.
Yeah.
And so it causes tension between them. That's but which great. I think fits with your theory even better, because his mind's not even going there and she's on her guard for male behavior. Anyway, sorry, continue.
No, that's fine.
I'm loving this.
Yeah. So at the same time that's happening, her breasts are also being used symbolically to sort of subtly introduce that there is this romantic attraction between them that's going to blossom. You remember that moment where we're told that she had taken off her coat to reveal a snugly, even seductively fitting cream sweater, and Strike addressed her hairline.
So good.
So good.
Classic.
Yeah, notice it's both funny, but it's also really important to tell us something about his true character.
Mm-hmm.
And then contrast that with Matthew. You know, she's at home with Matthew and washing up dishes. And he, that is Matthew, came up behind her as she was scraping the leftovers into the bin, put his arms around her and cupped and stroked the breast that bore the bruises Strike had accidentally inflicted and which had irrevocably colored his view of the man. So again, it's a touchstone. Strike is passing the test here, but Matthew, with his grabbing possessiveness, reclaiming his territory, I think fails the test. And again, we're told this very early on in the first novel. We don't even know much, but we're starting to get the inclination. So Robin's breast is an important symbol. Now fast forward here to chapter 88 of Ink Black Heart. I think Strike again passes the test. On the other hand, you could say, well, yes and no, right? He's not looking at what's right in front of him, meaning he's not opening his eyes to his attraction to Robin. Yes. So anyway, that's my theory.
I love this theory so much, Kurt, because you're right. The way Matthew treats her breasts in that passage, it's possessive. It's jealous. They belong to him and he has to reassert his control over her. And I never thought of this, but I have to believe that him touching her like that would hurt a little if it's so badly bruised, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You would think that Matthew would leave her alone to heal, but he doesn't. Right. Whereas, Strike is, you know, he's aware, but he's trying not to look, trying very hard. It's literally a perfect metaphor for the two different relationships.
It makes me think of, there's some point in that first chapter where he uses his fingertips to open the door so that he avoids getting close to her at all.
It's to get her into the office after he just knocked her down. Yeah. It's one of the things that I love most about Strike. It's how aware he is of his own strength and size and how that might intimidate or frighten women. And he's always very careful to make sure it doesn't, because he's such a good guy. Oh my God.
And his masculinity too. I can't believe you forgot to mention that.
Yeah.
That's the most important part.
His strength and his size, you got to mention his masculinity, obviously.
It also makes me think of all those moments where he's looking away when she bends over the computer and how he didn't quite manage it at the Ritz.
Yeah, he didn't manage it at the Ritz. We got to add that to the theory. He did look.
I mean, I love this. I think you're absolutely right. I think it highlights the differences between these two men. And the funny thing is that now that this is so well established that Strike is a good guy, I am really ready for him to start thinking these kinds of things more, which is why I like the Ritz. I think we're definitely at the point where he can think those things and not be weird or creepy. And I want it from her too.
Yes.
Very much.
We're told somewhere that he's no getting around, like something like the phrase is something like he's a full-blooded male, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, and that makes it all, to Poole's point, right? It makes it all the more meaningful that he is so conscientious about his body and his relation to people around him, Robin, especially.
We're also very, very conscious about his body. I know you said conscientious, but it's close enough. It's close enough to take dunk on that. Lindsay, I love that you want more strike thirst from Robin.
Yes,
I'm like, because we can identify with her. She's just speaking our thoughts. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. I love that.
But we don't get that from Robin as much as we get it from him. It's not fair. It's really not fair.
It's really not overdue.
Well overdue.
I was wondering if we're going to get a particularly sexy sort of comment.
Yes.
You mean from Robin's perspective?
Yeah, from Robin's perspective about him. That would be great. I don't think that I mentioned it whenever we were talking about the cover, but somebody on Reddit was mentioning that they were wondering if they saw each other only after long periods of time, if there would be any mention of, in Robin's internal monologue, her noticing the changes in how he looks and admiring the changes.
That kind of makes me want a long separation.
Right?
Just for that.
Uh-huh. Just for the reunion.
Just for her noticing Strike's body? Sure, I'll go with it.
You need her to describe it for us.
Exactly. Give me all the details.
So, going back to the chapter, do you think that this is the first time he's ever seen her in pajamas and in shorts? Because I know he slept over, but there's no mention of it. I feel like she probably changed in her bedroom.
Yeah, I feel like knowing these two, she would have definitely changed in her bedroom because she already felt conscious of the intimacy of handing him a pile of bed linens. There's no way she wouldn't have defaulted to, I'm going to keep my pajamas in the bedroom.
Yeah, I guess my point here is that besides him getting a little look,
little peek and see.
Yeah, he's just left Charlotte, who he knows is dressed for seduction, and she's trying everything she can to tempt him and win him back. And here Robin is in seemingly very plain pajamas, gray shorts and a matching t-shirt, but everything about her is tempting to him, particularly her heart for children she's never met, contrasted with Charlotte's cold, uncaring heart. I feel like I could just be spiraling down a swoon hole.
I'll join you there.
Yeah.
I love this contrast. Thing is that Charlotte's, all of her careful arts no longer work on Strike. Everything about her was always so carefully crafted consciously to appeal and to manipulate. And that's kind of reflected as he's noticed and thought about on several times, the attention she pays to what exact, you know, makeup, clothing, hair looks she needs to accomplish her purpose. You know, she's beautiful, but there's always layers of artificiality to her to be stripped away. And when you strip them away, they don't even stop at the surface. That artificiality goes deeper. Whereas here we have Robin being her completely natural self. She's freshly washed. There's no artifice to her. She's too concerned about the case and talking to Strike to even remember to put on a bra, let alone that she's in pajamas or care. It's just her, and he's real into it.
He is into it, yeah. Oh, I definitely think there's a point being made about everything being stripped away and seeing the hearts of these two women. Even though Charlotte is dressed for seduction, in Strike's mind, everything he's ever thought about her is removed. And for the first time, he sees who she really is. But at the same time, it's the opposite for Robin. I think he already knows Robin's heart, but for the first time, he's seeing more of her body than he has before. I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this, but this chapter does such a great job of showing the whole picture of his feelings for Robin, showing both the deep connection they share and his love for who she is, while also really highlighting just how physically and sexually attracted he is to her.
So I have a dumb question. It's kind of a guy question because I don't know what toweling robes and all this stuff are. So the phrase you used, Lindsay, was seeing more of her. And correct me here, she's wearing two-piece pajamas, right? Mm-hmm. And then a toweling robe over that. But are we supposed to think that, like, when she puts the robe on, she cinches up the belt? Or is it just, she just puts it on, it's open? Because it seems like there's this funny contradiction here with what Robin is wearing and what she isn't wearing and what Strike is seeing and what he isn't seeing. Yeah. I'm just really innocently trying to picture this.
I don't think she put it on until after he walked into the room. So at that point, he had already
seen it.
But then I do imagine that when she's just sitting there, that she doesn't have it tied, because it says when she moves, he can see. So I feel like she didn't tie it.
You know what I could picture her doing? I could picture sort of wrapping it and holding it very quickly, but completely forgetting.
That's exactly what I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, if she sits down, if she forgets, she's going to do the thing where she just pulls a leg up underneath, you know, to be comfy. So then her leg, the split in the robe, I don't think it's really covering that much.
Yeah, that's how I imagine it too.
But you know, a bit of shifting robe cover can make what's underneath even more intriguing. Because he got that glimpse. He knows that's going on underneath the robe right now. You know?
Sure.
Yeah.
I like when Strike asks for the bad news first, because I don't know about you guys, but I'm definitely the same way. I want to hear the bad news first.
It makes me wonder how long was she waiting and listening for him to get back, agonizing, thinking she'd screwed up and dreading having to tell him, but also wanting to see him. Poor Robin.
And I have to point out, obviously, that Strike sits on the bed because there's nowhere else to sit. I just want to thank whatever designer did not put a chair in this hotel room in real life, because I feel like I really owe you one.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think she had to search for hotels near the office that did not have chairs in their rooms?
It might be a bedsit hotel. Like,
is that what bedsit means? Just a bed that you have to sit on?
There's usually very little else in the room. Yeah.
Really?
Okay. Well,
today I learned.
It does remind me of that bit in Trouble Blood where they're in Skegness interviewing Douthwaite, because they both sat on the bed there because there was nowhere else to sit, right?
They did. They sat down on the end of it where the kissing swans were.
Oh, God.
The damn swans.
Yeah. I just remember that a little later when Robin sits down next to him, I was reading it like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Dying
sit
inside.
Sit closer. Strike. Pretend you have to stretch.
Yeah.
Do the classic. Aww.
Yeah, the classic.
When he gets up and leaves, he doesn't even say like, oh, you know, my leg is really bothering me, or a headache, or Lambuna or something like that.
He just runs
out of there. And it's just kind of, you know, again, it's one of those, you knucklehead, because save the possibility that someday, maybe, you know, but when you do that, you're closing down the possibilities. But you know what I mean? Like, why doesn't he just claim indisposition of some sort?
Like, no, I got to get out of here with the quickness. I don't have time to come up with excuses.
I get it. And he's had, what was it, half a bottle of Macallan's on it.
Yeah. His excuse might have come out even more awkwardly.
Mm-hmm. He's just like, boobs, I got to go.
That would have been really funny.
Your hair.
Robin, you're just too goddamn sexy. I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
I have washed. It kind of reaches a whole new meaning. Remember the perfume?
Oh, I love that. Right. Yeah. Robin then shows Strike pictures of what's been going on in the game while he was at the Rosses, which has three separate private chats. There's one between her and Anime, another between her, Hartella, and Worm, and then another between her and Paperwhite. And the tension that Joe's building up here is just perfect. So Anime reaches out to Robin, wondering why she's in the game when she should be studying for the mod test, and things get real creepy real fast.
Fiendy One just disappearing must have been a really unpleasant surprise for Gus. Do you think this was the impetus behind him deciding to close down the private channels? Because him knowing that Fiendy and Morehouse talked a lot, and now being incredibly paranoid about what they might have talked about, that's what makes him be like, all right, no, I'm shutting these people down.
Maybe. It could have also been that now that his use for Paperwhite is over, he wants to prevent it from happening again.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
While this is happening, Hartella opens up a chat with her and Worm.
Yeah, so Hartella is being a bit harsh. She seems very upset at Philip Orman's arrest. And I had to remind myself that she's so upset because that's now her partner in writing this book. So his arrest is probably really messing with her plans.
Right.
Yeah, that's why she's concerned.
She definitely does not want to think that the guy she was collaborating with is a murderer. But, you know, good news, Hartella. It's the other guy you were collaborating with who's the murderer. Yay!
Dun, dun, dun.
I would say poor Hartella, but y'all know I wouldn't be meaning it. Yeah,
so. I wonder if there's another character in The Running Grave that you're going to feel this strongly about as you do Hartella.
I hope so. I love it when Joe makes a character that I just loathe. It's so great.
Yeah. Is Hartella right up there with Umbridge?
No, no one's up with Umbridge.
Hartella reminds me of Tempest.
Oh, yeah, me too. Ooh.
And she's another aspiring writer, right? Oh, that has, God. You know, apparently crap ideas or just thinks herself more important than she is.
Yeah.
Hartella also seems pretty indifferent to Morehouse leaving, but I don't think that there was ever a close relationship there. And I'm just going to wait for Pools to say something about a genius like Morehouse wouldn't want to be chatting with Hartella, because I know it's coming.
I mean, you said it for me. I don't have to say it now. So thank you.
Yeah, I suppose it's fair to say that they wouldn't have had much in common.
Yeah, no.
She's also pretty nasty to Paperwhite. And it's kind of hard to know what to think now that we know the twist. But Hartella's anger seems to come mostly from the naked picture and her thinking that she's manipulating all the men.
I think this is 100% jealousy. Hartella is clearly pretty insecure. And the picture of Paperwhite is of a gorgeous woman. And Hartella's lashing out at her because of that.
Of course, it's also very convenient to have this here so that they can later go to Hertel and ask for the picture and try to find mm-hmm. Paperwhite. But I agree with you.
Yeah, I think it serves a dual purpose. It does that for the plot, and it continues to flesh out the character of Hartella.
Annamie immediately begins questioning Robin about who she has private messages open with and talks about completely shutting down the private chat function in the game.
This is probably a weird thing for me to focus on, but when he tells her that he's shutting down private messaging, I remember being upset on behalf of the people in the game, because private connection in a fandom is one of the best parts of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also don't do well with rules that make no sense or just benefit the person in charge. So I think I'd probably push back on this and then just leave the game.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. I think that Gus would find out that his game wouldn't last much longer without that private chat function, because it's a glorified chat room. People aren't going to stick around without the chat part of it. They'll get contact details from their favorite friends and then they'll bounce. I mean, they would have if he hadn't been arrested for murder. Now I'm wondering how long this game's hosting is paid for, like how long it's going to stay up after Gus is in jail. What kind of like weird anarchic ghost town would it become after he gets arrested until it goes offline for good?
That's a good question.
That would be,
can you imagine being in Drek's game the day after the news broke about this case? Because everyone would be in there freaking out.
Yes, they'd be losing their minds.
I mean, imagine our fandom when a bit of news drops and then we're all online all day freaking out. It would be that times 100.
And also, it would be much less happy, more murder.
I know.
But yes, the intensity would be.
Yes.
And if it's implicated in a murder plot, and obviously I don't know British law at all, but I would have to think they might have be able to get some sort of injunction to shut it down.
I'm interested. I want to know now what happens to the game. Does Borkel Drek take over and have his coding renaissance and make it a success?
It's Borkel Drek's moment.
This is my moment in the sun.
So the shit really starts to hit the fan as soon as Paperwhite opens up that chat with Robin.
We need to add a little bit to our growing list of clues that Annamie is Paperwhite. When you look at all the chats lined up as they're meant to be, you can see Paperwhite asking what Annamie is saying. Then Annamie asking, are you talking to anyone else in a private chat? And then back to Paperwhite, begging her not to tell Annamie. It's very laid out.
It is. Reading this bit is so awful for me because I feel like I can feel Robin agonizing, trying to figure out what she should do about Annamie asking her while she types. She's like, should I lie? Should I tell the truth? Maybe that's just how I'd feel in this situation. Like,
even on reread, you feel that. It's amazing.
I always thought that maybe she was feeling that in hindsight, because I got the impression that she wanted to help Paperwhite and connect with her because Paperwhite might know something and she wants to protect her. But yeah, it's tricky to know what to do.
Just larger Robin's character, I really identify with is her. I mean, she's so self-abnegating. She's so self-critical. And I just really identify with that. Of course, I don't want her to be, right?
Right.
And she has rarely has true reason to be. But it's really one of the things that is, I don't know if endearing is the right word, but it's a connection for me.
Yes, I feel the exact same way, Kurt. Bad habit of self-deprecation and constantly worrying that you've screwed up. She does worry about that. She screwed up a lot.
I blame Matthew for that.
Yeah, that's 100% Matthew's fault. Mm-hmm. Let's lay the blame right at his door. Right. He beat her down too much. He destroyed her confidence. Oh, I hate that guy.
And if he didn't create it, he certainly enhanced it.
Yeah. And I think we also need to add the ending of the chat with Paperwhite and Buffy Paws to this list because it's very dramatic and it doesn't fit with the tone of the other chat that we're seeing between Robin, Hartella, and Worm, where that just kind of ends. What I mean is Paperwhite is setting this up for a dramatic finale. You know, the don't get on Annamie's bad side ever, all caps, and then just leaving the chat. It's another part where when you actually look at the chats, Paperwhite types her last message ever, and then Annamie types his Latin phrase, and then Paperwhite leaves, and then Annamie blocks her. You can tell the way that it's formatted that Gus is just going back and forth between the two chats and the two devices that he's using to talk to her.
And he was definitely coordinating between the two. He's like timing this dramatic moment to coincide across the chats for maximum effect. This kid needs a life.
Yeah, but it's really good. It's really good for us. And it's easy to see when you look back that it's there. The clues are there.
Super is. Yeah.
Another really neat thing is during Robin and Paperwhite's chat, when Paperwhite says that she's leaving and Robin asks why, Paperwhite's response of because Morehouse was my whole reason for being here really is true on more than one level, considering that the whole reason why Gus invented her in the first place was purely to find a way to keep Morehouse in the game.
That is so good, Kens. I never thought of that. And you're so right.
Kenzie blew my mind wide open with that.
So we're back with Shrike and Robin, and Robin is upset with herself that Anami knew she was lying about talking to Paperwhite. And Shrike suggests that maybe he could see private channels. Do you think there's any evidence in this book that suggests that Anami can or cannot see private channels? Because I know a lot of people think that he can, but I personally don't think that he can, and that's why he created Paperwhite.
I don't think that he can, because if he could, he wouldn't be raging about people talking behind his back. And more importantly, if he could, that would mean that Morehouse would know that he could, because Morehouse coded it, meaning that Morehouse would never have planned to go to the police about him with Paperwhite in a private chat.
Yeah, because I remember doubting it. I'm like, why can't they see it in the private chats? And then I thought, well, probably Morehouse would have objected.
Morehouse would have objected because he's got some ethics. I mean, more than Enemy has.
And now he's gone. And so what does Enemy do? Psh, they're going to go away. Yeah.
Oh.
Dude's got a serious omniscience fetish, right? Yeah. He needs to know everything everybody's doing at all times.
Yep. But on another note, shouldn't these chats have raised the possibility that Enemy and Paperwhite are the same person in Robin and Strike's minds? Because there are only two real options here, right? Either Anami can spy on channels, or Anami is Paperwhite. That's the only way he could know. Although I guess there is a third option that Paperwhite is a real person, but is also a snitch reporting to Anami. That could be a thing. But the timing is so close.
It is, yeah. But it's definitely a clue that's there that they're missing.
Well, I think we know why Strike was distracted. And well, obviously. Think about it. But obviously. Robin, come on, girl. Maybe she's distracted by whatever he's wearing as well. We never get to hear about it.
I know. I love that Strike's first response here, well, his out loud response, is to come up with a plan and try and make sure that Paperwhite is safe. Part of this plan includes Strike going to see Yasmin, since they know she might still have the picture of Paperwhite. And I love that he says desperate times.
He's never even met her to know how annoying she is. He doesn't want to. He's just going off of Robin's description.
Yeah, maybe he listened to the interview.
Oh, God. Yeah, that would have put him off of her.
I know he probably doesn't mean it this way, but it kind of reminded me of when he said that in Troubled Blood, where he hoped to never have to speak to Irene Hixon again. It's because Irene and Yasmin kind of remind me of each other, and Tempest, like you said earlier, Kurt. So I can see Strike being equally as annoyed with both women.
In the battle of most annoying talking style, I don't even know who would win between Yasmin and Irene. Didn't I wish for Yasmin to become Irene's new best friend at some point? I feel like it's what they both deserve.
That was because we were talking about who would sit where at this imaginary wedding. Doing the seating chart for. Yeah, and I said that Irene, Tempest, and Yasmin should sit together.
Oh my God, that would be the worst table. I'd put Morris and Matthew at that table to punish them.
Oh, yes.
For being them. Yeah. Oh, that would be good.
I still, my money's on Irene because she's got years of experience like over Tempest and Yasmin.
That is true.
But if the youngins team up against the boomer, then she's... She's in trouble, but
I feel like Yasmin and Tempest would hate each other because they both want to be the most special one.
Yes.
They would be at each other's throats.
The most special one. Oh my God.
They do. They want to be the most special.
Yeah.
Anyway, apart from our fantasy wedding, which I would pay money to attend, going back to the actual chapter that we're like two pages into, I really love how when Robin tells Strike that she screwed up, he sees how wretched she is. And reflexively tries to comfort her and searches for something to say that won't make her feel worse because he doesn't want to make her sad.
And as much as I just want to say it's because he loves her, I think it's also because he knows how hard she's been working. I don't think he's forgotten that Edie came to Robin for help, and he knows how important this is to her and how much she cares about this case, you know?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
You made it worse.
We're back in the swoon wars.
We're back.
Robin tells Strike what the good news is, and it's that Kia has definitely been ruled out.
Huh.
As a side note, I'm so glad that Kia was feeling well enough to go out and celebrate her mom's birthday.
I can feel the sarcasm dripping from that.
Yeah, no, I really mean that.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad for this podcast confirming my own, like with Kia, because I just thought maybe it's me and maybe I'm just being, you know, callous and all that. And you guys have enabled my judgment of Kia.
We're equally as
You're
callous.
Welcome. Yeah. We're equally as callous.
Yeah.
We're not buying what she's selling, Kurt. The comparisons to Charlotte clearly point that she's full of shit. It's just a manipulation tactic. I mean, maybe it's all in her head making her actually feel bad, but I don't know. She can run. She can go out to eat oysters.
I love this bit so much where they say this leaves them with two suspects, Tim Ashcroft, the pedophile, and Pez Pierce, Robin says that Pez has been after a date and wonders if she should accept, and Strike gave a non-committal grunt. How much do you want to bet that he's trying to think of any way to rule Pez out without Robin having to go out with him again? I think it's so cute.
Right. Aww. He is not enthusiastic about this idea. I wonder if inside his head he's a bit worried that she wants to go on another date with him.
If you guys think this is cute, you wait for the running gray with a certain Mr. Ryan.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So if jealousy is cute, you're going to get
is cute.
I know.
Pink bows on the running gray.
I can't wait.
It's like half dread, half I can't wait.
There is no dread in me. I'm looking forward to every single agonizing second. Oh man.
And he is. What did J.K. Rowling say? He's terrible at hiding his feelings.
He's terrible at hiding when he's not happy.
Right.
I also have to point out that Strike had asked her if she wanted a drink while she gave him the good news. And at this point, the good news has already been given. They've talked about everything Robin had to tell him, but he still wants to stay in Robin's room and have a drink with her.
When they broke the whiskey out in this chapter, I was so hopeful that we were going to have a reprise of Troubled Blood chapter 58. Except where they actually, you know, talk or kiss this time. Alas, I was disappointed. But I've got my fingers crossed that we get a third whiskey night in the Running Grave. Third time's a charm, right?
When Strike leaves to go get a glass, it's at this point that Robin remembers that he's confronted Jago. But before she can ask him about it, Strike tells her that he got another call from the mystery Darth Vader caller. This time there's a slight difference where the caller, Flavia, actually refers to Anime for the first time. I just think it's really significant, and I wish I knew more about what Flavia knows and how she knows it, because it seems like she's always suspected that Gus killed Edie, but now she's also connecting Gus and the killer with Anime. I'm wondering how that happened. Do you know what I mean?
Part of me is wondering whether Flavia did a bit of snooping in Gus's room while he was away killing Morehouse. She would have found a lot of frightening things in there. And maybe something that pointed towards him being Anime, right? Or maybe in a less sinister, maybe Katya's been talking a lot about Anime killing Edie and that's how she made the connection, but...
I don't know. I love the idea of her snooping.
Ew, and I don't. I'm scared for Flavia at the thought of it, right?
Yes.
Because there were so many horrifying things in Gus's room.
And gross things.
First, we've got all the gross food and clothing.
And it probably doesn't smell good.
Right.
All those horrific drawings everywhere.
I'm positive Gus probably has a lock on his door, but I think... You know, this future detective could have figured out a way in.
Of course she could. She's brilliant. I'm in the Flavia fan club.
Same. Can I be treasure?
Yes. Right. I mean, the acronym like SPEW except for Flavia.
It should be Gus somehow, right?
Greatest unappreciated sister.
Sibling.
Sibling. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Strike says that he asked the caller who they were, and then there was a weird growl before they hung up. In my head, I feel like that was Flavia being really undecided about how or if she should answer the question. I just imagine that she probably went, but with the voice changer, it made it sound like a growl, right? Maybe that's just me.
Or just like, ugh. Like, you know.
Yeah.
And the voice was like.
She's saying, like you're saying, Kurt, because she's so frustrated that they haven't figured it out yet. She's like, you idiots.
Oh, my God.
Why haven't you done this?
That's exactly what I think it is.
Yeah, I agree. New headcanon. That's exactly what happened. Oh, yeah. That's funny.
They talk for a bit about who could be making the calls, and Bram is a likely suspect because he's creepy as hell and has a voice changer.
I'd have to imagine that if Bram was the one making the calls, he'd be saying way creepier and more disturbing stuff than this.
Yeah, of course.
I think that you're totally right. Any phone calls that Bram would have made would have been 100 times more demented. He's a creepy little fucker.
There hasn't been a single bois or muckfluck in these calls. Yeah. It's obviously not Bram.
It's not on brand for him.
I'm wishing that I had caught on that it could be Flavia, because she and Bram are about the same age, but Strike points out that no one at Northgrove knows the agency's investigating them, so.
Which should have been a huge neon sign pointing to Flavia. Yeah. So she knows that they are, and she told Robin about the voice changer. I feel like they're missing so much stuff in this chapter. It's like they're distracted or something.
It's weird.
Here she's done it to us again. You know, this brilliant moment where she's loading us with clues and pointing to Gus and Flavia's right there. And she's playing so fair in terms of the plot and the mystery and the murderer, right? Mm-hmm. But look over here. Look over here. I know. Look over here.
She's hiding it in the shit.
We're distracted by the boobs.
Yes.
There it is. But you start these novels and you say, I'm not going to fall for it this time. I'm going to be especially on my game when we get that kind of moment.
Never.
Nope.
Because we love it too much. You know, we love them too much. Yes. Yeah.
It's like in 58.
Yeah, exactly.
And we noticed she did it. And we said, we got to watch out during romantic moments. Did we? No.
No.
Will we? No.
No, she's too good.
But even Robin says that there has to be someone they're overlooking. And then she immediately asks about Gus's friends. I just feel like that's another nudge in that direction, getting us to think about Flavia.
The further we get in this novel, the more frustrated I am with myself for not figuring out that it was Gus. Come on, me.
I really like this line. Both drank some whiskey, then stared blankly into thin air for a while, contemplating this new problem. The vapor from Strike's e-cigarette drifting between them. I think the reason I like this is because we all know that that's not the only thing drifting between them. And I really like the imagery of the vapors kind of representing everything that's swirling around between them.
Yes, I love that. Can I also take this opportunity to say, related to this image that you've pointed out here, I love how in these novels, Joe is taking these classic noir detective tropes and she's twisting them to make them into a real person. I mean, okay, I know he's not actually a real person. I am aware of that, but a character who feels real by right. showing him growing away from these tropes onto a path of healing. Because what self-respecting noir gumshoe is going to be sitting here vaping? It's an absurdity, right? But Strike is, and we're over here cheering him on for taking that step. The image doesn't look ridiculous. It looks poignant and hopeful, and it's creating sort of that beautiful metaphor that you pointed out with the vapor swirling between them. I'm now having a lot about the Strike books as Joe's take on noir fiction and like what they're saying about the world. I feel like they're changing the sort of pessimism and cynicism of that noir world to something that's a lot more optimistic and joyful, where happy endings and justice are possible.
I just love that. And as you know, I'm big into that. I really need to put my thoughts together and post something for you guys on that kind of thing. So,
I would love that.
Yeah. I love noir.
Do you? I was about to ask if you read a lot of noir, because I actually only know from like cultural osmosis.
I don't know if I would say I've read a lot, but I'm reading more and more every chance I get. And I just really connect with the genre. I connect with, as you said, with its really this cynicism. It's the word that keeps coming to my mind about it is it's suffocating, especially for these male figures. And, it, you know, as you say, like, I think Rowling wants to say something about that. And it is trying to move her characters out of that.
To let them breathe. Yeah. Yes.
But I think Robin's the key to that. She's not, you know, what a noir detective would call a frail, right? This misogynist term for a woman, right? She's capable. She's becoming a true detective in her own right. And I think she's sort of the antidote to all of that.
Oh my God. So I good.
I feel like you're about to get pulled like right in the heart there.
You already did. Well, actually, you've got me in the brain because I want to go write a paper on this now.
It's really hard to go back to the case after that, but they talk a bit about Rule 14 and what Annamy and Morehouse were trying to achieve with it. Does anyone have any ideas of how or why they started it? Because I feel like it would have appealed to both of them.
Yeah, it definitely would have. Because Morehouse would have been all for an excuse to keep his real self totally hidden. I can sort of imagine a conversation between them in the early days about whether they should implement, you know, rules for modding, and Annamy suggesting just one rule. I have to wonder if Morehouse knew why 14 was Annamy's favorite number, because it was from the 14 women that Lupin killed, wasn't it? Like, was that in the book or am I just making that up?
No, I looked it up and it does say that in chapter 105.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad I'm not imagining it. But I have to think that Morehouse wouldn't be okay with calling it Rule 14 if he knew that that's why, right?
No, I agree. Yeah, he doesn't know, because that's disgusting.
He'd have to be pretty deep into incel culture to know that the number 14 is referring to a specific massacre of women, probably.
Yeah. They go back to Pez being a really good suspect because of Josh's stolen vampire drawing. And I like Robin's reasoning here. He's definitely got the skill set. He had a grudge against Edie, but Anime just doesn't sound like him. The Latin, the obsessiveness, the vitriol. I'm not saying Pez didn't have complicated feelings for Edie. He definitely did, but he wore yellow to her funeral because it was her favorite color. If he's acting, it's a better act than I've ever seen. I think it's easy for us to say in hindsight, but I do think that she's got a really good read on Pez. It could just be because she spent actual time with him.
Yeah. And it's going back to that point that if either of them had had an extended interview with Gus, I feel like they would have been able to pick up on something being off about him, right?
Yeah.
Especially Robin. Although on the other hand, maybe Robin feeling sorry for him with his hives and his shyness and having an abusive parent could have clouded her judgment. But I definitely agree with you. She's got a pretty good read on Pez.
Well, she's seen him naked. I
mean. Yeah, she's seen him naked. She's had his tongue in her mouth.
Oh, that's right.
She knows the guy now.
The sad thing is that some of the reasons why Robin feels pity for Gus are also the reasons why he should be considered. You know, an abusive father, being a sort of recluse.
Mm-hmm.
Great point.
He smelled her shampoo again as her hair swung forwards, and though trying to keep his eyes on her face, he noticed her breasts move beneath the thin t-shirt material of her pajama top.
Thin. I feel like that's important.
Thin.
It's important in my mind.
Yes.
Yeah.
As we were saying before, I love that this tells us that her robe is not tightly tied around her anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. I'm here for this.
Yeah.
I feel like she's so clearly focused and intent on the case and so comfortable around Strike that she forgets. She just doesn't notice her robe's undone because of those things. And I really love what that says about her. And about them.
Not to prattle on again about my theory, but this goes all the way back to the beginning of Cuckoo's Calling, right? He established that space, right, of comfortability from the beginning with her by maintaining that distance, by opening the door with his fingers to give her plenty of space, the whole thing. And look where it's brought them. It's really beautiful. Yeah. I just think it's great.
Yeah, it is.
We know she's noticed that he never makes her feel uncomfortable in that way. And because of that, she's now safe to just live. Oh my God. Okay.
Retiring to the emotions closet.
I'm also cracking up that Robin starts talking about Evola, but Strike says, what? Because he's just thinking about her boobs, or he's trying not to, but we know he's failing. It's really good. Mm-hmm.
So good.
I want to know exactly what his thoughts about her boobs are. Like, of come course. On, Strike. Don't be shy. Tell us exactly what you're thinking or trying not to think with apparently every single brain cell you have.
See, that's the only thing that could distract him from a case is Robin's boobs, right?
Yeah, apparently.
The fact that it can distract him from a case is just a miracle. We know how focused he is.
Inquiring minds want to know what he's thinking.
I want to hear it all. Yeah.
But anyway, this is also one of my favorite parts of this book because he's always so cagey about admitting just how attracted to and in love with Robin he is. The fact that one glimpse of her without a bra completely derails his brain, like sends it off the track.
Yeah,
I love it. It shows how powerful his attraction to her really is. And I know, I just like when he's a guy, you know, he's a respectful guy, but he's still a guy.
I mean, to be fair, there's a lot of recorded evidence of how we talk about Strike, maybe shirtless and other things. So.
Maybe.
Just to be fair.
Maybe.
But yeah, I love this too.
Shout out to all those fans looking for coconut matting.
I was just telling Rachel last night that I will never ever get over in my life that Joe read and liked that thread.
Yep. So good. Never. She got to see the thirst up close and personal.
Now these are nutters, she said.
She wrote it. She loves it. That's great.
She knows.
It's like duly noted, write more shirtless scenes with Strike.
She knows what she's doing to us.
You know, if we get that in Running Graver 8, you know who to thank. You are welcome.
That's right. Gaston.
Exactly. I think I found a really fun clue here. While Robin is thinking of Evola, she gasps and says, he's in the Northgrove bathroom. Yes, she means the book with Evola, but for us, the readers, that's a clue to the killer's identity because who actually is in the bathroom at Northgrove? There's a portrait of Gus Upcott, and I just think it's so fun.
Oh, shit. You're right. An astute reader, upon reaching this point, might have gone back to that bit. to check out all the books that were there. Maybe notice Gus's picture, connect it with the reveal that Katya has no talent. Yeah. Again, though, I'm not an astute reader.
No, because Strike is thinking about Robin's boobs. We're not stopping to go back.
We're not stopping to go
She's
back.
She's hiding it. I just really, really liked this clue. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, she's hiding it in plain sight. And maybe I just have the sort of potty brain toilet humor kind of thing, but he's in the North Grove bathroom. Evola is, meaning Evola is a shit, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, kind of I thought it might be a joke in that way too.
Of all the bathroom reading I could choose, weird racist theories of eugenics aren't really up there.
Weird pools. Okay.
So weird. Not really my first choice.
They also come really close to guessing that the Evola Twitter account and Anime are the same person, but they're not quite there yet.
Kills me when Robin backs off from that idea after Strike asks her whether she's suggesting they're the same person. Like, yes, follow the idea. What would it mean if they were, Robin? What if Anime has a bunch of sock puppets? I know that they can't get there yet because it's too soon in the book. This is just a clue for the reader, but still.
I feel like you could also be talking about their personal relationship there. So close, but backs off. Follow that thought, but too soon. Yeah. All right, let's get to the part where Robin asks how it went with Jago, because this is some good stuff. Strike tells her what happened, and Robin says how glad she is. And actually tells Strike that she thought that he was just going to hold this over Jago's head. He doesn't say anything about this. I wonder if he thought, thanks, Robin, or something. I feel like I've been more upset about this than he seems to be.
You're really angry on his behalf.
I know. I just wish I knew his thoughts. But he's probably, you know, still too distracted by her boobs to really think about it. Anyway, but then we go to Charlotte. So Robin also assumes that Charlotte will want to get full custody. And Strike says, she doesn't seem interested in sole custody. It'd hamper her social life. Robin notes that she had never heard him talk about Charlotte like that before, which I love.
I need more details about what exactly that tone was. Was it disgust? Was it indifference? Tell me more about what his tone was, Robin. I need the details.
Mm-hmm. Maybe she isn't sure.
Yeah, she's just like, that's a weird tone.
Or I bet you she is because she's so observant, but she, again, won't trust herself, her feelings enough to think it's disgust or you know, something really strong, like some repugnance.
I'm definitely hoping that we'll get to read him talking about Charlotte like this in front of Robin more often, you know, so that she really gets the point that Charlotte is not what he wants anymore.
Yeah, maybe he can throw in little bits of what he does want and make Robin go crazy for 7 chapters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'd really like lighter hair.
Just, really. And she's like, does he want to get back with Madeline?
Oh, no.
Women with strawberry blonde hair from Yorkshire.
I didn't know Madeline was from Yorkshire.
So then, sadly, Strike just books it out of there and Robin's left wondering why.
Yeah.
It says, Robin was left staring at the door, wondering why Strike had left so suddenly. Had memories of Charlotte overwhelmed him? 16 years of pain, he'd said in Cambridge. But there must have been pleasure, too, to keep drawing him back over and over again. Well, that's Madeline's problem, not yours.
Oof.
Yeah, it hurts. If only she knew why he had left.
Mm-hmm.
The exact opposite. Side note, was I the only one dying that he hadn't told Robin that he broke up with Madeline? Because
nope.
Oh, not at all.
I was screaming in my brain, you know, tell her the truth. I am begging you.
Tell her the truth.
Yeah. We were so close to them talking.
Again, this is the second chapter where it's been so close like this. The other one was at the hotel.
This is such a book of painful what ifs, right?
We could have had it all.
Rolling in the deep. Yeah.
Rolling in the deep.
But then we get this amazing part about why Strike left, and it's so swoon worthy.
Oh, I love this part.
This is so good.
Do you want to read it, Kenz?
He thought it best to remove himself from Robin's vicinity. Barefaced, sweet-smelling, and conspicuously clean in her pajamas and robe, talking intelligently about the case and expressing compassion for children she'd never met, she couldn't have presented a greater contrast to Charlotte. Strike feared loss of control. Not some clumsy physical overture, although much more McAllen, and even that might have been a risk. But a caving in to the temptation of talking too personally, of saying too much, while the two of them were sitting on the same bed in an invitingly anonymous hotel room.
God.
Yeah, I need the emotional support closet.
It pulls makes incoherent noises from her emotional support closet.
Do you think that this suggests that Strike knows that Robin's no in the beginning is not a definite final no, or is he really worried that it is still? Because at this point, why not go for it? He knows that she's not dating Hugh Jacks. He's broken up with Madeline. Why not just let yourself talk to her and be open unless he's really afraid of being rejected?
I think that he is still afraid of that final rejection, right? Because he mm-hmm. hopes, but a big part of him is still scared. She doesn't feel the same way because later on, when she tells him she doesn't want to lose him, it lightened mm-hmm. a burden he'd barely known he was carrying. That burden was his fear that she doesn't want him the same way. So yeah, he doesn't want to be rejected by her.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think you've just won the swoon wars for today with that one. Yep.
Do I get a prize?
Just my suffering.
Oh, mm-hmm. well, that's sure. That's something at least.
His reasons for leaving. This is such a conspicuously non-physical thing here. That is to say, it's the loss of control. It's not the physical overture. It's the emotional. It's, you know, wanting to open himself up emotionally, sharing too much. That's the vulnerability that he yeah. really fears. And what is it that puts him over the edge with Robin? It's really not her boobs. It's the contrast with Charlotte. It is her mm. caring about children she's never even seen, right? It's yeah. all of that on top of the physical that's definitely there. It's really extraordinary.
I love that you point out the real fear of emotional vulnerability, because he was already rejected from the physical. Mm-hmm. He did already get that physical rejection, or he feels he did. So what's it is just that emotional rejection that he can't handle, because that's even more important.
The key phrase for me is talking too personally, saying too much. See, talking and opening up, that's been him from the beginning of the series, right? He's still there.
The very last line, it was quite enough that their office was currently in ruins and the enemy case virtually impenetrable. He didn't need to screw up the only relationship that was currently keeping him sane.
Oh,
I guess this might confirm that he's still really afraid of her rejecting him because he doesn't want to screw up this relationship, or he's afraid that he'll screw up a romantic relationship if she did say yes, because we know in Troubled Blood, he thinks when it goes wrong. So I wonder if he's worried about his ability to have a successful relationship with her too.
I think so. He's afraid of what's going to happen if she says no, but he's also really afraid of what could happen if she says yes.
It seems like something he should maybe talk about in therapy or with a newly found therapist sister. Just saying. Talk about with somebody.
If it gets to suggestions of stuff that Strike should talk about in therapy, I could give him a list.
Yeah,
broken down.
Oh my God, I'm just imagining the running grave again, and I'm thinking about if he'll talk to Prudence about how he's feeling about this whole like stuff with Robin.
Even if he just talks to Prudence, I'm fine with that, you know.
Yeah, that would
I know
be great.
Some people don't agree that he will go, but I think it's possible, but I'm fine with it being Prudence as well.
Yeah.
Just talking.
So good.
And I do have a note in my ebook at the end of this chapter that says that at first I hated that he left because I did want more, but I also don't want anything to happen between them as a reaction to Charlotte. So I think I still feel that way, even though it kills me that he left.
Yeah, he does think that she's such a contrast to Charlotte. I don't want him to be thinking about Charlotte at all. I want Charlotte yeah. to be on the other side of exactly. the universe in his brain.
I want him to be thinking of the Taylor Swift song, I Forgot That You Existed. You know? Okay, should we jump to 89?
All right, chapter 89. Murphy invites Robin and Strike to New Scotland Yard to discuss the case.
The epigraph reads, "The mighty are brought low by many a thing too small to name." And that's from Danger by Helen Murphy Hunt.
I think this is just about the Havening and their downfall.
I agree. That's exactly what this is about. The poem describes how people go to any lengths to feel that they're safe. They'll construct huge defenses, fortifications, but they can never know everything. And it often is that the tiniest thing they don't know about brings them down. And for the Havening, it's getting too drunk and dropping real names. But there are also other people brought down by little stuff in this book too, because for Enemy, it's using musicians in his Twitter sock puppet accounts and a fear of dogs. So I think this applies to the Happening in this chapter, but also it's always the tiny things that bring down these murderers.
This is one of J.K. Rowling's favorite themes, isn't it? About dictators and fascist people that want to control everything, right? And they're always too smart for their own good. And it's those little things that bring the cracks in the edge.
And Voldemort dismissed love as inconsequential, and love destroyed him.
Mm-hmm.
Their love destroys me in this book.
Okay. That was grateful.
Thanks.
So Strike heads to Denmark Street for the first time since the bombing. And when Robin asks over the phone how the office is looking, he tells her it's better than he expected. And of course, I have to highlight and focus on the fact that there's still no glass door in the office. And I'm wondering if this is the moment when he decides to do it, to get her name put on the door. It makes sense since they just had this moment a few days ago where he thinks of her as his true partner and how he's all amazed and in love with her from the previous night, you know?
Aww. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I can pick, he's in the office. He's looking at the door. He's thinking about how they're going to need to replace the glass and bam, brilliant idea in his head. Should have thought of it sooner.
I have been swooning over this glass door for a year and it's not stopping.
Yeah.
Never. Yep.
I have to take the opportunity of being on here to say how impressed I was that you all spotted the glass door at the beginning of the novel and knew it was coming at the end. And mm-hmm. You guys pat yourselves on the back.
I think we were so easy to spot it because it's something that we specifically have wanted for a very long time. This very specific gesture, we wanted it.
I can't remember when I started wanting it, but I know it's been a long time.
We manifested it is what happened.
We did manifest it. Our vision boards worked.
You did, because it literally manifest in the sense that it's the title of your podcast, right? And Ellicott Files, right? So you called it from the beginning.
So Murphy calls and wants to see both Strike and Robin. And he's a bit cryptic about it.
I really like this bit where he's clearly happy and cryptic because this is the exact thing that Strike does when he solved a mystery. He's smug and he's secret about it until he can have his dramatic monologue moment. That's mostly in Lethal White because he always tells Robin eventually. It's the reader he keeps in the dark. Anyway, Murphy is clearly excited for his big dramatic monologue. And part of me wonders if he wants to impress Robin a little with it.
I'm sure.
Too bad for Murphy that he's got some stuff wrong and didn't actually solve the murder, which is another way in which he's Strike Light, Diet Strike.
I mean, I think of course he wants to impress Robin, but I can't really blame him because Strike does the exact same thing with showing off in Cuckoo's Calling, and it's adorable. I love that.
It is really cute. We know it works for Robin. So.
I have a little advice for Murphy if he's trying to do that. Don't hand her rubber gloves and doggy waist bags, right?
Yeah.
I wish I could be in Robin's brain a bit because it says that Murphy came to collect them and it must have been a little weird for her. So it's the man that she's agreed to go out with, the man she's in love with. Her brain must have been pinballing back and forth a bit. Like, oh God, can Strike tell that Murphy likes me? Can Murphy tell that I'm in love with Strike?
Mm-hmm.
This probably is not happening, but I like the idea.
I 1000% believe that this is happening. Yeah. Robin's there just like, okay, act natural, Robin. Don't be suspicious. Don't be suspicious.
I like it.
Play it cool.
So Murphy says that they're there because of a cat and there's a recording he's going to play. Angela Darwish is in the room. The recording starts and it's Wally Cardew. So basically Wally logged into the game to try and find out who Annamie is to get revenge for him pushing Oliver Peach, right?
Yes. Charlie / Heimdall, who we now know as the boss, believes that Annamie pushed his idiot brother in front of a train. And now he's out for blood because he may have been an idiot. But it was his idiot.
His idiot. Murphy and Darwish wanted Strike and Robin to figure out who Wally and this other person were talking about. And it's Pez. And basically, since Wally thinks that Pez is Annamie, the happening is now after Pez. And they needed Strike and Robin to ID who they were describing so that they can warn him.
I'm laughing because Robin so easily identified Pez right after they said that his nickname was Horse because he had a massive and then they get cut off. Even if she hadn't gotten the bits of his name that they recorded, that nickname would have been the giveaway and she'd been like, oh, Horse, that's Pez.
I know everyone thinks this is funny and I get it, but they literally said most of his name.
And I just say it took me an embarrassingly long amount of time to figure out what Murphy was talking about. He says, you're here because of a cat. I was reading for the where's the cat come in? I get it now.
The amount of stuff that I've only realized while we're talking about it, even going through carefully with notes, while we're literally, I'm like, oh, that's what it means. Yeah.
I guess the biggest thing I'm taking away from these recordings is that the police really do seem to have the happening under control and all the right people in their sights. And I think that part of Murphy wanting them to go down was so that he can tell them this in person.
I agree. He's really pleased. He clearly likes Robin and he likes Strick too. They've been a big help.
Yeah.
He wants to pay them back because he seems to be pretty decent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I've been saying, he wants to have a little show off. It's cute. I like Murphy. I'm excited for him in The Running Grave.
You know, come to think of it, he does like Strike. He laughs at Strike's jokes there. He gives Strike credit when he shuts off the tape and Strike says, so while he was trying to figure out who the enemy was, bang on, right? So there isn't that kind of, well, I don't know. I guess we'll find out to what extent Murphy is jealous of Strike or the possibility of Strike like other people have, certainly Matthew. But so far, he seems to be, as you say, decent.
Yeah, I think he likes him.
I'm really looking forward to how that relationship changes in that grade. Oh, I can't wait. Once Murphy starts to be like, wait, hang on. Is she in love with this guy? And then Strike's like, God damn it. Oh, it's going to be good.
I'm still really hoping that somehow there can be a resolution where he can remain a good contact for them, because I like him so much better than Wardle.
Me too.
I gave the police and Murphy a bit of a hard time about them having it so wrong about Edie's case, but I am really glad that they focus so much on the happening, because I do want them to be safe and for it all to go away.
Finally, the police are useful for something. Clearing the Nazis out of the way so that Strike and Robin can focus on the real mystery.
How
to admit they're in love.
It's so good because Galbraith never gives us, like, okay, yes, there is the murderer, but there's always other criminals involved and other criminal behavior that the novels are trying to expose. And I think this is a great example of that.
She's like, the police can have a little solve as a treat.
Yeah, like you were saying, Kurt, there is this part here where Strike makes a joke and it makes Murphy laugh. And just like we were talking about, I do really think that these two men like each other.
Strike is really funny in this chapter because he makes Darwish laugh out loud too. But yeah, he and Murphy seem to get along well because Murphy doesn't have, like you said, that chip on his shoulder that Wardle does. But I don't have high hopes for this friendship.
I'm hoping. Yeah. I saw on Twitter yesterday that Anna Kiara said she wanted Murphy to meet Lorelai, and I thought that was funny. Because who knows, maybe Murphy's really into cowgirls.
Vintage,
Murphy's like, yeehaw.
I can see it. I can see it. Lorelai would be a nice girlfriend for a guy who could emotionally commit to her.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm there for that. I would not introduce him to Madeline.
No.
Strike's ex-girlfriends, that's got to be Lorelai.
Yeah. So they start talking about the rubber masks, and Murphy says that the Havening has been using them. And of course, we know that Gus got these tips from the genius Val Petora.
The genius.
Yeah.
The note that the maker of these masks does them to any specifications creeps me out. Because I'm betting that Gus sent him a picture of Vikas's face and said, make that a mask. And if the mask is modeled on Vikas's actual face, it makes a bit more sense that a distracted academic would hold the door for him. Also, it makes me, how long was Gus planning this murder that he had time to get that custom mask made especially from Germany?
I know.
Oh my God.
Really long time, I bet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kicking myself a little bit here because in the last episode, we were wondering how Vikas's murder went down, and I had forgotten that he got a mask that looked like Vikas's face and used a wheelchair, and that's why someone let him in. It seems so risky, doesn't it?
Well, he's starting to get ballsy now, like really ballsy.
He's not reckless. A careful killer.
Yeah.
But, you know, he could have played it off as being like Vikas's friend who's there to pull a practical joke by,
I guess,
riding around in a wheelchair with a mask that looks like him. But people would be like, okay, that's a weird joke.
Do you remember when in Cuckoo's Calling, when Strike is confronting the killer and he's pointing out how he starts taking more and more risks?
Mm-hmm.
And Strike says, yeah, and why shouldn't you? Because you had such damn good luck. And I feel like some of that is mapping onto Gus here.
Gus is the exact same breed of reckless, lucky killer.
Yeah, sociopathic killer, yeah.
Pushing a guy off of a crowded subway platform, that's risky as hell.
Mm-hmm. It is.
He's arrogant and he thinks he doesn't need to be careful because he's got that God complex thing going on.
We also learn more about Ormond and what really happened, about how he had that tracking device on Edie's phone and how he saw Anime all bulky and weird with that mask on.
I know that we knew Ormond was tracking Edie, but it's still so upsetting to hear about how he was watching her phone during the detention he was taking, and then he takes off raging. Like, I guess it's a reminder that even dudes who aren't murderers can still be really scary, because that scared me. I was like, oh my God.
One thing that stands out to me is just the tiny note that Edie's phone case was bright yellow, because we know it's her favorite color.
Aww, I didn't catch that. That's really cute. Yeah,
just a tiny bit of personality that I liked seeing, because I don't feel like I know Edie that well.
Yeah, we don't.
I guess not compared like to Margo. Yeah.
Here's another one of those little things that makes the difference against Gus's favor. In other words, he sees the yellow phone in Ormond's hand, right? Do I have this right?
Yeah.
So he knows and just takes off running. And so, yeah, I just feel like it's a kind of another little decisive thing that tips the balance of events against Gus's plan.
And then here, as they're walking out, Murphy gets a chance to let Robin know that he's been busy, but he will call her about that date. And it says that Strike is oblivious because he's ahead and checking Twitter on his phone.
Goddamn Twitter.
How many of us have been distracted by Twitter? I too have been very distracted by Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just hypothetical here. What do you think he would have done if he had heard? Would he have said something or scowl at the wall for another 20 minutes?
I want to say scowl at the wall because, you know, yeah, that's a striking thing to do. Uh-huh. But it is the realization that Robin has a date planned that wakes him up later. So that same realization hitting him here, having the same effect, maybe he would have said something. Maybe while they're having drinks in the very next chapter.
And I go dark.
Sure.
I think if he had seen what was going on, he would have said, I fucking knew it. I was right at the Ritz. She's not interested in me. Aww. It would just been confirmation that she had rejected him at the Ritz and there's nothing, aww, there. And don't even try it. And what the fuck are you thinking, you stupid idiot? Just run your agency and live in your attic flat.
Okay, well, that's making me really happy that he didn't see it.
That's right. Yeah, see, I'm really telling you to be happy.
Oh, poor Strike. Don't put those words in his head. Don't manifest that.
Someone really just needs to give him a hug. Me.
Where's the phrase hovering on the abyss? Like, there's, it's somewhere in there. Yeah, anyway.
No, I don't like it.
You don't have to have me back on, you know?
I just want Strick to be happy.
Is anybody thinking about Harry being jealous of Ginny?
Oh, yes.
Chess monster, the chess whole monster? Nine yards.
Yeah, we're very totally much hoping, okay, for good, a chess, all right, monster,
I just,
yes,
wanted to do that sort of sanity check that I'm not the only one sort of thinking. No, no, and no, looking forward, definitely, to similar, not, moments, possibly, oh, with Strike. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Only it's going to be so much more fun.
I want him to be featured in Alien. There's so much bursting out,
oh,
of
my,
his,
gosh,
chest.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah.
I want it to be obvious, too.
Yes.
I would like
so
that
obvious,
very much.
I want Robin to be in no doubt that he is absolutely, yeah, dying with jealousy.
I think she's been a step ahead of him since at least Troubled Blood in terms of getting, you know, in touch with her feelings and being honest with herself about her feelings. But I think that might quickly change, but we'll see.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
Okay, should we go into chapter 90?
Yes.
All right, in this chapter, Robin and Strike discuss points of the case that they didn't discuss with Murphy.
And the epigraph, we lack yet cannot fix upon the lack. Not this nor that, yet somewhat certainly, we see the things we do not yearn to see around us, and what see we glancing back? And that is Later Life, a Double Sonnet of Sonnets by Christina Rossetti.
This poem is another really close repeat because we just got this poem as the epigraph of chapter 86. And that's the chapter where they catch up and have a team meeting. Kind of like this one's catching up.
Yeah.
But I think that this is pointing towards the fact that there's, I don't know, bear with me as I try to explain my thought here, that there's a piece of information they can't see, but they don't know that they can't see it because they don't know what it's there. Like all of the sock puppets, especially the Lapine's disciple connection actually being enemy, with that piece of info, everything would come together, but they don't know, they aren't seeing it, even when Strike sees so much else that's right about the case.
No, I get you.
Yeah.
I don't have anything else to add. I think you're right.
They got spot on.
Also, someone needs to open up his eyes or he's going to start walking into walls.
That too.
Bouncing off of door frames on a regular basis.
I was just thinking about that, yeah.
But this chapter kind of really sums up everything that's happened so far and why Strike doesn't believe the police have it right.
He admits that the police have some decent reasons to think that the happening is behind everything, but his reasoning is just better and explains more of it, which is why he's the protagonist of the novel.
Yeah, and that brain is one of the reasons why we like him so much.
The main reason for me. Well,
that chest hair, it's about either one. It's,
oh,
fine.
My God. I just realized that Strike has also been compared to a horse, just like Pez.
Clydesdale.
Yeah. So I'm just saying.
He has cart horse blood.
Blood in him twice. Okay. Well, now that's canon that he and Pez are similar in some respects.
I love the cart horse thing because it's physical, but it's also his class.
Yes. He's a working horse.
Right. And not aristocratic. Yeah.
Oh, I love that comparison. Also, something I love, Strike being gloomy about having to eat a veggie burger with no chips. First of all, it's an entire mood because I too often desperately search for something that I want to eat that plausibly supports weight loss. And Strike, bad news for you, buddy. The two things so rarely overlap.
It's one of the things I'm so looking forward to in the retrograde,
I can't
to
wait.
See his success. Yeah. He makes the argument to Robin that Annemie's the killer, and I don't think there's anything he gets wrong. One of my favorite bits is obviously when he calls Via Pretoria an idiot.
Yeah, he says the base assumption is that Oliver Peach is an idiot. I mean, yeah, that's not an assumption. That's not speculation. That's just facts. We know.
We all know.
Yeah.
I guess just in general, I love that Strike nails everything. You know, he recognizes the patterns and the timing for anime to be told information about Bitcoin and buying things anonymously online by Viral Pechora. He notices the change in MO from the Havening to anime. He sees that anime's cold about Morehouse leaving the game. It's hard for me to see why the police aren't picking up on these things, but I guess when you get tunnel vision, it's hard to change perspective. Mm-hmm. Or it's just that Strike is so intelligent and brilliant.
I mean, obviously. Yes.
Yes, obviously.
I think that maybe Murphy bringing down the Havening is a huge high profile case for him, presumably. Like, that feels like promotion material.
Yeah.
So part of him might want this to be the Happening, all of it.
Yeah. And also, he could just be really focused on them.
Yeah.
And there is a connection to anime. So it's not terrible. It's just not right.
We're getting Strikes, you know, how in Career of Evil and those other places where he'll put it all together, like Sherlock, and he sees the end and then he'll try to get Robin up to speed, you know, without telling her. I think this is that kind of moment here. Only instead now, with them being more partners and she's now a full-fledged detective, they're going to be working in tandem. So he's kind of teed it up for her and then she's going to knock it home.
Yes.
It's still the same Strike. And look, he's got all this issues going on with his leg, etc. But they're just kind of really working as a team.
This is the same thought process he went through quietly alone, but now Robin is naturally a part of that thought process. He's fully brought her in. She's in the inner circle of his brain.
And she's ready for it and a part of it.
And making it better and pushing it.
Right. But we can't forget the epigraph of the chapter because, I mean, it does tell us they're missing what's right in front of them. I don't want to overlook the fact that they're overlooking, right? But I do think we're seeing a different case-solving dynamic here.
I think so, too.
I love that.
I'm going to file that away mentally to look for in the running grave.
Speaking of Robin pushing Strike's thinking, I love how often Robin opens her mouth in this section to object or to challenge Strike. And he always cuts her off because he knows exactly what she's going to say, which is funny in itself and shows how well they know each other. We know he enjoys it when she pushes back and challenges him. He's obviously already Robin-proofed this theory. So he's like, Robin would say this. No, yeah, I got it. It's solid.
That's chef's kiss on that phrase, Robin-proof. That's,
Robin-proofed the
argument.
I'm
going to steal that. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, them trying to make Swiss cheese of each other's theory is one of my favorite things about their dynamic.
So there's an interesting little atmospheric detail here where the table beside them has teenagers ignoring their parents and typing on their phones. Is it a reach to say that this is pointing towards Gus's enemy, completely isolated from family, immersed in his online world? Or I guess more plausibly, this is just a little emphasis of that digital real life separation that we see in the novel.
Yeah, I agree. It's probably a reach to get to Gus, but I can totally see that it's emphasizing this digital world that we've been living in for almost 1,000 pages.
I mean, to be fair, though, that instance between Darcy and Gus, where he's at that party that she invites him to, and he's just over there, like sitting in the corner on his phone or whatever, not doing anything. And he ends up hacking into Marcus, what's his face's iCloud or whatever, that has the picture that he ends up using for Paperwhite. Admittedly, it's still a little bit of a reach, but still.
But Gus does do this. Hopefully these teenagers aren't murderers. Hopefully they're just on Twitter.
And not hacking into anybody's iCloud and catfishing their best friends and then murdering them.
Fingers crossed.
And of course, we have to mention Robin ordering herself a veggie burger with no chips in solidarity with Strike. Aww. And I just love that he says, but I could have nicked some.
So good. Strike's kleptomania has finally been foiled by the woman he trusts most.
Ultimate betrayal.
Also, here's a weird thing. It says that he picked up his knife and fork. Was he about to eat a burger with a knife and fork?
He better not have been. Maybe it came with a salad.
For some reason, I thought it did.
Why would you need a knife with a side salad?
Well, maybe he wants to cut the burger in half.
You wouldn't use a fork for that. You would hold it with your hand and cut. I've done that. Is Strike one of those psychopaths who just eats finger food with cutlery? Does he do this with pizza? Have we finally found Strike's fatal flaw?
Someone is slowly raising their hand.
Oh, Kurt, no. He's like, guilty.
You know what? It's always the people who look the most normal.
Maybe it was just symbolic. The knife and fork, just picking up knife and fork is just symbolic. He's about to eat.
I'm thinking it could just be an error.
Yeah.
I guess we'll have to learn to love him anyway, Pools.
Yeah, I hope it's an error.
I'm not willing to concede it's an error.
Oh, no.
Maybe for Strike it is.
Let's jump into chapter 91.
In chapter 91, Strike speaks with Yasmin. The epigraph for this chapter. Her hair stood back on either side, a face bereft of loveliness. It had no envy now to hide, what once no man on earth could guess. It formed the thorny aureole of hard, unsanctified distress. And that is The Other Side of a Mirror by Mary Elizabeth Coleridge.
This is another repeat poem from chapter 49 when Strike interviews Kia Niven. Last time I argued that the woman in the mirror was Kia's conjured up image of herself, of the suffering victim, an object of pity. Here, I think it's much more straightforward. All of Yasmin's confidence and delusion has been stripped away from her. She has nothing to hide behind. Her distress and her fear is completely visible.
I agree with you. I think that Yasmin's delusion of her situation and her behavior is equal to Kia's own delusion about herself and her behavior.
Yes.
So I really like that you pointed out that the same poem is used for both of them, because I think they're the two characters who are really living in that made-up world.
They are living in worlds that they've made up in their head. I like that. Yeah. Before we get into this chapter, can I say, I don't think it's fair to make us read another chapter of this uptalk. I just don't, okay? Why did you do this? I'm on strike. I mean, I'm not on strike. Like, we all wish that. The other kind where you walk off.
I understand.
Walk off. One letter that would be changed.
Okay. Wondering why you're laughing so much. Okay. So the chapter opens with Strike getting to go home. And I love that he sits at his table and orders new things for the office. It just makes me happy to think about their updated office at the end of the book after the bombing. You know, it's that whole Soviet coagula thing.
This sentence here, Strike whiled away the rest of the afternoon vaping. That is a sentence that I never thought that I would read.
Right.
I'm surprised.
But you know, Pools, it's another one of those moments of the transmogrification of the noir trope, right? Instead of the detective spending the afternoon smoking and thinking in his office, he's vaping.
And buying new things.
Right.
Nice new things.
Yes. Yeah. Right. With the detective's office is always run down and old furniture and curtains that need to go out for cleaning and that kind of thing.
Not now. It's a non-smoking office. I'm so proud of him.
This is kind of a random aside, but I like how well they're doing financially, that he can just afford to like drop all this money on like a new desk, a new computer, a new computer chair. That's a lot of money.
They might have insurance. Right.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Still, I did think the same thing, Ken. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, wow. Look at you. Not even batting an eye about it.
Maybe this computer even has a DVD drive.
Fancy. Moving on up.
Okay. So are we ready for more up talking?
Do you think I'm ready?
I think we're ready for more up talking.
I just wish Robert Galbraith hadn't chosen Veronica Lake.
we had to Google Veronica Lake and we're like, how far does the hair go over the eye? Like,
almost
what is
ruins
happening?
It for me.
Oh no.
Do you like Veronica Lake?
There's a great noir film you should all see with Veronica Lake and Alan Ladd called This Gun for Hire.
This Gun for Hire, hey?
Yeah, it's good. I think it's 1948, something like that. Anyway.
Maybe that's why she used Veronica Lake.
There's a kitty cat in the opening scene too.
And Yasmin has tiny little cat teeth, as we discussed.
She does, yeah.
So at the mention of the happening, Yasmin breaks down. And when Strike mentions the dossier, she still tries to cover for them. And she said that she put it together herself, which is so weird.
I'm sorry, Lindsay, that's not right. She put it together herself?
Oh.
Oh my God.
You're right. Sorry, okay, I'll fix it. She put it together herself?
Oh, I hate it so much. But this is the stupidest lie, because wouldn't it look worse for her if she was the one who put together the dossier that was clearly a happening ploy? Like, wouldn't this cross her mind as a dangerous thing to be saying when she's already afraid of being connected with the terrorists? Like, one would think, right?
Willful dumbassery is starting to seem like a bit of an understatement right now, right?
Yeah, I don't get it.
It's a good phrase, Kenz. I like it.
She's still not wanting to believe what's right in front of her, but
still willfully denying what's right in front of her.
I do have some sympathy here, though, because I can't imagine what it would be like to all of a sudden find yourself in the middle of a terrorist investigation. And Annamie's been threatening her too. She's probably terrified.
Yeah, she definitely is. For some reason, I've realized that the uptalk in this chapter doesn't bug me as much as I thought it would. Mm. Maybe because it's interrupted so many times by her crying, so it's not in huge chunks. Or
yeah,
maybe I do feel a bit bad for her. Who knows? Oh,
someone needs to check if pigs are outside flying. No, I know what you're saying though, Bulls, because I feel like there's a layer of arrogance that's been removed from her. When she was mm-hmm. talking to Robin, she's very pleased with herself. And here that's totally gone, so it's less annoying.
Yes, maybe it was that quality that was really bothering me about her. Like mm-hmm. people being pleased with themselves when they have no reason to be, that great. Yeah, maybe that was it.
So she starts talking, and here's where she tells him that she had believed that Lord Drek was an actor, and the story of how she went to the stage door. And honestly, I feel terrible for her during this part because it is so humiliating, like she said.
Yes.
It is so painful to read, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Is anybody else reminded of Strike himself, actually, in Troubled Blood, when he tells the story of going to the studio with his mom to see his dad and that rejection mm-hmm. kind of thing? I don't know if it fits this uh-huh. scenario, but it provided this unexpected moment, like you were saying, Lindsay, of sympathy for Yasmin in a chapter where it's pretty scathing toward her. And her behavior. And
I can see what you mean, because they were both expecting the other person to want to see them. And then there was this slow realization that it wasn't true and the humiliation they both felt. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And I hate to say this for obvious reasons, but now that you've made that connection, I'm also seeing the connection between Yasmin and Strike, where they both really don't see what's right in front of them. And it's incredibly frustrating.
Oh my God.
Sorry, Pools.
Unsurprisingly, I hate it. Yeah. But I see what you're saying and it makes sense.
And I always find it really interesting to see what approach Strike takes with different people that he's interviewing. So with Yasmin, he's very direct, not totally cold, but definitely not sympathetic. I think Yasmin has been in such denial and has lied to herself for so long that nothing other than shock and blunt facts are going to shake her. So I think this was the right approach with her. And in some ways, it does feel a little satisfying because she's been so willfully blind this whole time.
Just like the slap upside Strike's head at the end of the book feels satisfying to me.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
I know.
God damn it, you two.
No, I thought the same thing. Yeah. What do you think about his approach with her?
I mean, what do I think apart from the fact that I loved it? Because I did really love it. But no, I agree that this direct, blunt approach is best, because being soft and sympathetic with her is just going to encourage her to make herself look better. It's just going to try and build her back up. No, you don't want to do that. You gotta shock her. You gotta get the actual truth out of her. You gotta break her down.
You gotta have somebody who's not gonna like sugarcoat it with any bullshit. Straight facts.
Yep. Bucket of cold water. And he gives her good advice. He's like, you need to go to the police. Here's this guy's number, Ryan Murphy.
Yeah.
It's good advice, right?
It is. It's almost a kindness to scare her into going to the police. Because her choosing to ignore this, she's putting herself directly in two very dangerous paths. And I think she needed to be scared.
Mm-hmm.
And again, reminded of Strike, nothing but shock makes him see the truth. So
God damn it. Yep.
You don't like the Yasmin being compared to Strike?
It's not your favorite thing. It's not my favorite thing.
I'm sorry.
But I get it.
But I think it's there. I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that pertains to his leg too, Lindsay. Nothing but shock, makes him see the truth and the state of his health.
Yeah.
Has to be completely broken down.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this a bit before, but do you think that there's any way that Yasmin's book ever gets published? Because Strike points out to her here that her two co-authors either did it or were arrested for killing Edie, and that all the extra ideas about the Inkblack Heart that she got was taken from evidence from the murder scene. It's actually not a terrible selling point if she ever does get it done.
Yeah, she could turn this into a trashy kind of tell-all, you know? Collaborating with a killer. What it was like working with the man arrested for killing Edie Ledwell and the man who actually killed her.
I think that's the only angle she can take now.
She could try to cast herself as a sympathetic hero somehow. Spill all the dirty details, the tea. It wouldn't make her look good, but it'd probably make a lot of money.
You guys are forgetting something. She's a dumbass.
Oh, yeah. She's too dumb to do this.
That's an important point.
I don't know if she's smart enough to take this route.
I mean, I think she's pretty good at spinning a story. I bet she could do that. She would end up on shows like Nancy Grace or Dateline or something.
Oh my God, she would.
Not Nancy Grace.
I don't know who would be more annoying, Nancy Grace or Yasmin. There's another fun little clue, I guess we can call it a clue, where Yasmin tells Strike that she thinks Inigo is anime, and Strike's response is, why do you think it's Epcot? Mm. It just feels like it's really close to the truth, right? It sort of is.
Right, mm-hmm. Because it's definitely an Epcot, just not the right one.
Yeah.
I had Katya as my big suspect for much of the book.
Me too, Kurt.
You know there's something dodgy about the Epcots, but you're not sure what it is.
Right, and I kept thinking Janice.
I was doing the exact same thing, Kurt.
Right in front of our eyes.
If only we'd opened our eyes, you know?
Well, that's the fun thing about all of this, right? Is the book literally keeps telling the reader of the mystery book, open your eyes, open your eyes, open your eyes.
It's also fun that Yasmin and Inigo both thought that the other was anime.
It kind of reminds me of that, like, Spider-Man pointing at each other meme.
Oh, I love that.
The whole cast that's of this great book are all Spider-Men pointing at each other. I'm desperate to see someone make that meme.
Yasmin explains her reasons for thinking Inigo is anime, and some of them I think are fun because knowing Latin and anime sounding like Inigo really still can point to Gus because sons will sound like their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I'm going to give Yasmin because Inigo is not a bad guess, and all of her reasons, they do make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. He's mostly housebound. He has a lot of free time. He's an artist. He's angry at Edie and all of the Ink Black Heart people. He has a horrible temper, and as we've said, anime sounds like him. And I think a lot of people were thinking it could have been Inigo. So I think her guess and her reasoning is probably the best and most logical out of all the suspects.
Yeah, I can't really give her grief about this because I was wavering towards Inigo too for a lot of the book. Yeah. It's not the worst guess.
I think it's the maybe one of the better guesses.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Maybe that's another thing she's hiding because we're not listening to Yasmin.
Yes, God damn it.
Who else was like that? Oh, Irene got a bunch of stuff right that we all kind of dismissed. Right?
Oh, yeah, because no one's going to listen to Irene.
Yeah.
Another thing to not keep track of at all in the running grave. What is the annoying character saying?
Yeah. Strike then asks her about the Christmas party and her kiss with Nils. We joked in a previous episode that she was like, I'm anime as the concept, but I don't think that is true now because I believe her genuine confusion over the actual meaning of the word anime. I don't think that she has any idea what Strike is talking about. And when he mentions the stained glass, she's not really that observant.
So it was just a misheard statement?
I kind of think it's plausible that she could have just been drunk and going along with whatever Nils was talking about.
Uh-huh.
And doesn't remember the details now because she didn't actually absorb any of it. She was just like a parrot, drunk and dumb.
Yasmin says that Anami would kill her if she gave Strike the email. And here's where Strike tells her that she's probably right and that Morehouse has been murdered. I can understand her need to not believe it, but I still want to tell her to open her eyes a bit. She's denying too much.
Yeah, it says she looks like she might throw up. If I were her, I'd be pretty close to throwing up here too, because she definitely would have been next on the list.
When Yasmin's dad comes in and asks what's going on, he says, is this still about that damn cartoon? And I feel like this man has had it with the Ink Black Heart.
Oh my God, this is giving me such parent who doesn't understand what the fuck is so interesting about this stupid internet shit vibe.
I also get the impression that there could have been some difficulties for Yasmin. And
yes.
He's probably seen her very emotional about this before.
Yes, and he's very sick of it. He's like, just get off the internet then.
Log off.
Touch some grass.
Touch some grass, yes.
Another refrain of this novel. Go touch some goddamn grass, please.
Can we just pause for a minute and fanboy, fangirl about the ability of J.K. Rowling to just give a character one sentence and they leap off the page as a very vivid character like that.
This is a dad. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then finally, she does give Strike Anime's email. Do you have any thoughts about it? It's cagedheart14@AOL.com. AOL.
AOL, exactly.
AOL.
What the hell is you still using an AOL email address in this day and age?
The best I could do was, well, maybe, again, like father, like son, you know, old guy on the internet, he just, Inigo would have AOL, you know, and that's not a stretch. So maybe, I don't know. That was weird to me.
Getting past the AOL thing. Caged Heart was from those lyrics he quoted to Robin mistakenly earlier in the book, Heart in a Cage by the Strokes. And then there's his favorite number again.
So then once Strike tells her to contact Ryan Murphy, she ends up telling him that Anami has been blackmailing her and about how she's been logging in as Anami for quite some time. I cannot imagine how this must have felt for Strike.
He has been so pissed.
He calls her dangerously obtuse. And I gotta say, I get it.
He is so angry. Mm-hmm. Like, I know it makes me kind of terrible, but I really enjoyed reading the absolute rage building up. He cannot fucking believe. He cannot even with her. Mm-hmm. The fact that she doesn't even understand why what she's been doing is so dangerous and dumb. He has to literally spell it out for her.
This reminds me of that time when he called that colleague of his a negligent twat back in Career
Yeah,
Evil.
That was good. That was good. Maybe we'll get more Hardacre in the Runny Grave.
But I really want to see Carver too, because he was so much fun to hate.
I love Carver.
He was very irritating.
Yeah, we haven't seen him since what, Career of Evil now at this point? It's been a long time.
Maybe he was let go from the Force and he's been lying low building up his supervillain arc this whole time.
He's going to become a serial killer.
He's got like his crazy wall going in his basement.
Wish Strike pictures.
Yeah.
He started a cult in Norfolk.
You know, I like to think ahead to the trial, so I can't help but feel sorry for her because everything that she's done is going to be all over the media. It's going to be really hard for her, and her dad is going to lose his whole mind over it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dad's going to be pissed.
Chapter 92.
Robin convinces Rachel Ledwell to send her the picture that Paperwhite sent to Morehouse.
In the epigraph to this chapter, tonight again the moon's white mat stretches across the dormitory floor, while outside, like an evil cat, the pion prowls down the dark corridor, planning, I know, to pounce on me, in spite, for getting leave to sleep in town last night. And that is from The Fete by Charlotte Mew. Another repeat poem, this one was from chapter 40, but I think that this pretty obviously speaks to Robin's moments of fear in this chapter, alone in her apartment. Both her general anxiety about the happening and those specific moments where she hears a noise outside and even worse than gets a death threat over the phone. Like, she's afraid.
Yeah, I agree. And Anami is the evil cat.
Aww, that's mean to cats.
So this opening sentence is really great. At first, Robin felt glad to be home in Black Horse Road. It was a little strange to be suddenly alone. No Strike to talk things over with or to sit with in companionable silence in the car. But the slight sense of dislocation could be ignored while loading dirty clothes into the washing machine, putting away her toiletries, watering her philodendron, and making a trip to the supermarket to restock her fridge.
I just have to say, congratulations to Robin for finding the most creative way to avoid saying that she misses Strike.
Mm-hmm.
She totally misses him, though. Come on, mm-hmm. It's so cute.
She misses him so much. What's keeping me going, one day, she's not going to have to miss him when she goes home, because they're going home together and he's going to be there too. One day, we just have to stay strong and hang in there, like mm-hmm. the cat poster says.
I know exactly what poster you mean. Uh-huh.
Everyone knows.
Yes. What if we got that in the Running Grave where Strike admits that he misses Robin?
One of them needs to say that they miss each other if she's going to be undercover gone like that.
Yes.
They need to say a lot of things.
They need to say a lot of things. I know. First of all, jot that down, Strike and Robin.
Yeah. But I love that watering her philodendron is on her list of priorities.
I know.
Because that has to make her think of him every time she waters it.
Oh, yeah.
But I do very much understand why she feels so uneasy at home. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to have someone there with her, you know?
Someone big and strong.
Exactly. Pez? That's exactly what I was thinking. No. Not what I was thinking. But speaking of Pez, she gets a text all about how the police came around and told him to go into hiding from the happening.
What a thoughtful guy. He's such a thoughtful guy, that Pez. Yeah.
It's a bit bold to not only ask her to stay, but then to give her an attitude when she says no.
Honestly.
This guy.
Apart from the fact that you've been on one date, you haven't slept together. You just told her that you have terrorists after you.
I know.
What woman in her right mind would say, oh yeah, come over. This feels safe.
Yeah. Come on. Can you imagine basically saying, oh yeah, sure, you have people over to someone you've met, what, twice?
The audacity.
The red flags.
I know I've gone back and forth about my feelings about Pez, but overall, I don't think that I'm a huge fan. I just think he has a lot of growing up to do.
Oh, you know what? This gives me a rare opportunity to say something positive about Wally Cardew. because remember, he's all sus on Pez, right? And has told Josh, hey, you know, he's trying to steal your girlfriend. And we can kind of see, you know, Pez actually does think very much of himself, very highly. And so, gosh darn it, Wally, there's something to your theory.
You have no compunction about stealing your girlfriend.
Yeah.
Strike calls and tells Robin that everyone they've ruled out is back in because of Yasmin covering for Anime. That was such a smart move on Gus's part.
Yeah, well, no one ever accused him of being stupid. But the way Strike ends this phone call, he says, yeah, narrows it down to a few 100,000 women. If you've got any good ideas about how we identify which of them is Paperwhite, call me back. It's hilarious to me because Robin's just like, all right, hold my beer. 5 minutes later, here's her full name, her socials, her location. She's just so good at this detective shit. I love it.
Oh my God. I love her. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but Robin has my whole heart.
So Robin's jumpiness and her nerves are written really well in this whole bit. The flashes of Vikas murdered, the double checking that the door is locked, and Robin tells herself that she's being ridiculous, but she's not being ridiculous because we all know that there's still a very real danger out there. And I think Robin knows that too.
This fear is super relatable to me because if I hear a strange noise in the house, especially if I'm alone, I'm frozen and I'm panicking.
Yeah.
Although for me, it's usually the cat trying to give me a heart attack by doing something stupid. And I've never had an actual killer after me.
No, I'm the exact same way. Do I always double check the locks and the alarm? Of course. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
Of course. Yes.
Yeah.
Do I grab a knife and stand there like this waiting to see if a murderer comes down the stairs? Yes. Always.
Yeah.
Am I kind of afraid there are people living my walls sometimes? Maybe. I had a dream about it once. It was really scary.
Therapy edition. Robin gets the idea to message Rachel to try and see if she can help find Paperwhite. I have a feeling that Rachel wanted to contact Robin after she found out about Morehouse being murdered because she knew that they were going to talk to him, right? I bet she was itching to contact her.
Yeah, this poor girl. I feel so bad for Rachel here because I can only imagine how upset she's been. Not only because of the guilt and fear, but because Vikas was her friend and she never got a chance to make up with him and she never will now. And it's really upsetting.
So sad.
Poor girl.
We see more of Rachel being really smart and putting everything together on her own. Basically, Rachel is starting to understand that Anime did this and Robin is glad because she wants Rachel to understand why they need help finding Paperwhite.
Rachel's so smart putting it all together. Only Strike has made that connection so far about Valpatrol telling Anime how to get the stuff on the dark web.
Yeah.
I know Rachel had a head start because she witnessed Valpatrol joking about it, but it's still a really good deduction.
Lindsay, I think you mentioned before, like a criticism that people have brought up about these books about Joe being unsympathetic to teenagers and stuff. And I just get like a very Harry Potter-esque sort of vibe from Rachel where like the adults in her life, they don't understand. And she sees the truth for what it is. And nobody around her wants to take her seriously because she's still a kid.
Yeah.
I think she's very sympathetic to teenagers.
Yeah, me too.
It's definitely a vibe of the teenagers have got the right end of the stick here, and it's really the adults that are not open to that.
I love that point. Yeah. And I also think she's so brilliant at writing teenagers, adolescents, getting in touch with those experiences.
She remembers somehow.
Yeah.
I always try to forget.
We all block it out, but she remembers. Right? Yeah.
You know that quote in Harry Potter where Dumbledore talks about Neville's grandmother? I think it's Neville's grandmother. Being the type to forget what it's like to be young.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, I think that she's very careful in not doing that. Yeah. Robin asks Rachel if she was ever shown the picture of Paperwhite and if she still has it, and thankfully they get it.
I love how carefully and sensitively Robin asks about the picture. She makes sure to give Rachel this plausible deniability to let her save face in case, you know, whatever reason she kept that photo is something she doesn't want to admit or be accused of.
Yeah.
It's great because she automatically removes any reason Rachel might have to feel defensive and she makes her feel comfortable sharing.
Robin has such a talent at that.
Yeah. And I like that it mentions beforehand that she knows she has to go into this and ask this sensitively.
Notice that Robin's sense of compassion and sensitivity doesn't blind her to hard realities or the complexities of human behavior or, you know, just the failings of people, right? She's not overly sentimental to the point of blindness or naivete. Yeah, she navigates that so carefully.
And I think even more so as the books went on, you know, not being able to believe a woman could be so brutal in Silkworm, for example. But I think that as she's toughened up as a detective, I guess, and been exposed to so much of the world, it's helped her develop this empathy into something that's a really good tool.
I think the Holly Brockbank interview as Venetia Hall was a real watershed for her in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really love Robin doing the reverse Google image search of Paperwhite's picture because yeah. it reminds me of us doing reverse Google image searches on Joe's headers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. Even the little bit where she crops it just to her face. It's actually a really good tip on how to get good results. That's how I mm-hmm. found the church.
Mm-hmm. That's so funny. We have all been where Robin is right now.
Yeah.
Maybe for us, it's not about protecting someone from a murderer, but
sure.
surely deciphering clues about our favorite book series is just as important, right?
We needed to know what church that was.
It was life or death
information. It was.
And that we would die if we did not know. So, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Robin has a lot of self-control to not immediately call strike once she gets the picture. She's either so caught up in the search or she wants the satisfaction of finding the answer and calling him back with everything.
Oh, you know she wants to just present all of the information tied up with a little bow. I feel like she'd want to tell him in person just to see his face because yeah, we know she likes course. To do that. Uh-huh. But that might be fighting with the urge to surprise him with how fast she managed this because it was really fast. Mm-hmm. So if I was Robin, I'd be like, what do I do? FaceTime. That's the answer.
They need to FaceTime more.
Yeah, yes. They do.
I know a lot of people really want a book where Robin cracks the case and figures it all out. In this book, Strike is the one who theorizes and guesses everything correctly. He's basically spot on about everything, but Robin is actually the one who finds most of the evidence, right? Mm-hmm. She kills it in this book.
She basically cracked it at the exact same time as Strike in this book. Yeah. She makes the connection, figures out Enemy's identity by herself in the same chapter that Strike does, basically. He doesn't need to explain it to her at all because she's right there with him because she's his equal now.
So if before, Strike cracked it and then was sharing it or not sharing it with Robin, maybe in the running grave, she cracks it and then it becomes a question of a kind of ticking time bomb plot where she has the information, she's got to get out. Will she get to him in time? You know what I'm saying?
Like, amazing.
She has all the answers and something like that. So where it's reversed, right? Where he doesn't know, she knows.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And he has to try and figure it out so he can save her.
Sometimes I remind myself of how Joe said, I don't know when, but I remember somewhat recently, she said that Troubled Blood was still slightly her favorite over the Ink Black Heart, but that mm-hmm. she's really loving writing The Running Grave, which tells me that this might be her new favorite, which makes me so excited.
Yeah. Oh, so boy.
I hope that she'll answer that. She usually says it's her new favorite, so maybe we can ask her when she's back around.
Yeah.
And it's very exciting once Robin finds the real girl in the pictures. And I think I remember that I pretty much instantly thought that this was not going to actually be Paperwhite.
You're smarter than me because I was actually totally surprised that it wasn't the real Paperwhite because she and Morehouse had an argument about the blonde guy in the photos earlier in the book. So I assumed, it was her.
That's just because you don't watch Catfish as much as I do.
Yeah, or at all.
Yeah, I knew right away. I was like, no. This would not check out on Catfish.
But side note, the Twitter account that Nicole retweets, Women's Art, is real and it's great.
Yeah, I follow that account.
Yeah, we both. Yeah, I do. At Women's Art 1. It's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it. And then the chapter ends with Robin getting a threatening call saying, I'm going to kill you. And we know it's Gus. Mm-hmm. I don't know why Robin doesn't immediately pack a bag and force Strike to stay in the same hotel room with her because that's what I would have done. Mm-hmm. I'm biased,
A big strong man next to you, etc.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, hell no, I am out of here. I'm up for some tension-filled bed sharing with Strike.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, the killer's waiting for her outside.
Well, calling Strike and not leaving on her own was smart for the reason you just said. Someone could have been outside. So I like that she calls him and makes a plan. I just wish that she didn't immediately fight the plan, but I guess we can get into that next time.
I wanted Strike to stop walking, grab a taxi to her place. She's got an elevator. She can take care of him with some tea and, whatever else might help him feel better. Would have been so cute.
Non-NHS stuff.
I'm not saying any specific stuff, but
Yeah, but then we wouldn't get the whole Madeline thing that's coming up, which is really good.
Mm. Well, yeah, it is good.
No, it was good that she came up with the plan, but yeah.
That'll be for next episode.
Yeah, what a way to end a chapter.
I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, oof. We made it.
We did.
This was absolutely so much fun. Fantastic. an honor. Thrilled to be a part of it.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it was really, really an honor. A lot of fun and absolutely everything I was expecting. So it was really good. Thank you.
Well, hopefully we could do it again, maybe for the Running Grave.
That would be great. Really looking forward to the Running Grave. I told Lindsay, I think, I would not be surprised if it soon becomes my favorite of the series.
I know it's going to instantly become my favorite.
So, Kenz, what are we doing next time?
All right. Next time, we're doing chapters 93 through 97. And in those chapters, Madeline stabs Strike with her shoe. Strike visits the hospital for his leg. And Strike and Robin interview Nicole Crystal.
I'm very much looking forward to the Madeline bits.
Yes.
Good stuff there.
Oh, yeah. That one's super fun. That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.